opposition to the private sector, which may see that kind of investment as inherently risky. It's important in the context of immature regulatory capability and also in this very volatile global marketplace that we have a forward-looking infrastructure investment program. Government investment does not preclude operational provision by other elements of the economy, notably the private sector, so there is space for that in various parts of how our SOEs operate. And while such investment is a prerequisite to sustaining the economy, it will not enable a transformation of the economic trajectory alone. So our focus here is to try and have infrastructure as a lead to investment. The challenge in respect of industrial development is to accelerate the development of very specific technologies which are associated with advanced manufacturing capability and capacity, and to focus on doing this where we seem to have some competitive advantage as a country. Infrastructure investment can create demand conditions in this space, so in a way these things work together. And you will see this in both the case of Eskom and Transnet, where demand conditions around infrastructure can become a preemptor of industrial development. In its very complex, high-risk areas of manufacture, it's also very important that the state plays some informing role, either directly as an ownership, as through ownership, or through policy development. And this is an area where we work very closely with DTR. If I can pass on to Ursula, who will deal with the next element of the presentation.
Okay, thank you, XMTG. So I'm focusing on the shareholder management processes that we undertake at DPE.
I'm trying to check the what to call the presentation on our document here. I can't see this one. Which document are we in here?
There are two documents. One is the DPE shareholder oversight. This is the one they're addressing at the moment. And there's a second one, DPE annual report. Okay. Those are the two documents. They're addressing the first one at the moment. Are you satisfied?
Which is, I mean, the same. Yes, we do have the document. But what appears there, unless it's on a different page, you see, from that we have. Okay. The presentation to the portfolio committee at 14th today, but I can't find it, but I'm sure they'll work on the other side.
We asked the secretary just to sort it out to members. Some members have the presentation they're doing, and some, it seems, do not have it. Can the secretary just sort it out? Acting GD, can I just get the indication of your time allocation for this first part and the second part, that we can just manage the time?
Chair, I expect that the first part of the presentation would be roughly about 35 to 40 minutes. If we move through it without questions, and an annual report we can do within a similar time frame if we move quite rapidly.
Are you satisfied with that? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. So with respect to our shareholder management processes, the DPE's mission essentially is to ensure that the SOE are financially sustainable and that they deliver on government's developmental objectives. And what this entails is an optimization of the alignment between the SOE's role in the national economic strategy, as well as the performance of the portfolio of enterprises that report to the DPE, and that's through DPE ensuring that we deliver best practice shareholder management services and that we engage with stakeholders to ensure that there's an enabling environment to effect such alignment. So our shareholder management process is really entailed in balancing between the enterprise interest as well as the national interest. And with regard to this, what we've done is we highlight the distinct responsibilities of three key role players. That's the shareholder, the SOE board and management, as well as the policy responsibilities. With respect to the shareholder responsibilities, what we wish to highlight is that the shareholder owns the shares, and the shareholder being government and the minister being the shareholder representative, and that the enterprise assets are actually owned by the SOE as a juristic entity. And what these shares do is that they give the shareholder specific rights and powers, which include the right to appoint all the directors, both non-executive directors as well as the executive directors, and the right to approve significant and material transactions in terms of the PFMA, the right to issue, or with the power to issue a strategic intent statement, and this is done really to guide the SOE board in fulfilling the responsibilities as well as fulfilling the SOE mandate. The conclusion of a binding shareholder compact, which is required by the Treasury regulations that are issued under the PFMA, and these really set out the mandate as well as the key performance areas and indicators for each SOE. Access to information that will then enable us as the DPE to monitor and evaluate the performance of each SOE in fulfillment of statutory requirements. And enforcing the accountability of the board and management of SOEs, as well as taking remedial action that is regulated under company law as well as the PFMA, as well as finally the production of good practice notes to guide the SOE board and management in running the SOE. Then, as distinguished from the shareholder responsibilities, the responsibility of the board and the management are to ensure that the SOE is financially sustainable, and this they do through coherent utilization of the SOE's assets as a juristic entity. And secondly, they're responsible for developing and implementing the strategy of the SOE, and in this regard, that would include developing strategic and business plans as well as subsidiary plans for the SOE subsidiaries. And this would include the areas of financial risk management, operations, marketing, and so forth, which really relates to the operations and business affairs of the SOE. And then the next responsibility relating to strategy is the appointment of management and staff. That's, again, within the domain of the board and the management. The management of all aspects of the SOE's operations. And then finally, the development of detailed company policies, for example, remuneration and procurement. And these would be within the guidelines that have been developed by the SOE to ensure that there's an implementation of company practice and that it adheres to the policy. And then the third aspect, which relates to the policy and regulatory responsibilities, is set out here. And so once the perspectives are accepted, what then this means is that funding of the SOE is derived from a commercial tariff because, and this is also largely because the scale of the infrastructure challenge for each SOE is too large at this stage and that it can be it cannot be funded from the fiscus alone, hence then the commercial tariff would be used for funding. And that government then needs an enterprise in each sector to ensure the continuity of the strategic intent. And then what we also then wish to highlight is the separation of SOE from policy departments, especially with respect to regulatory responsibilities of the policy department. And this would really need to be ensured that the SOE is independent of the policy department, just to avoid conflicts of interest, firstly between consumers and SOE interests. As you may be aware, the primary function of policy is to advance the interests of the consumer. So the SOE would need to be independent from the policy department just to ensure that that policy function is not conflicted with the shareholder responsibilities. And then secondly, to avoid conflicts of interest between the SOE and the private sector, because sector policy would then set the competition policy or the regulation of competition within each sector, and each sector would involve both private sector and public sector players in a number of instances. And then also we need to ensure that the regulator is seen to be independent so that it can set a fair price between the private sector and the public sector.
Looking at the shareholder management practice in practice, the department has developed a shareholder management process, which we term the logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation process. And this is basically an annual chronological cycle of tasks and events that seeks to link national strategic priorities to SOE delivery. It also seeks to ensure that effective shareholder management is undertaken in relation to that the desired objectives are actually met. This process starts by the formulation of a strategic intent statement, and this statement is the primary tool to communicate the state's expectations of SOE strategy. In formulating that statement, there are intra-governmental consultations that are undertaken. The DPE consults with the policy departments and other departments, just to ensure that there is clarity and transparency for the objectives of that SOE, and also to ensure a precise articulation of the trade-offs between policy, regulatory, customer, and the financial interests of the SOE. This consultation entails an assessment of the interaction between the policy and regulatory environment with the financial and operational goals of the SOE to ensure shareholder value optimization and achievement of wider socioeconomic objectives by the SOE. Following that, then Minister and the SOE conclude a shareholder compact annually, and documents the key performance measures and indicators to be attained by the SOE in delivering the desired outcomes and objectives, and these are agreed between the SOE board and Minister. This is in terms of Treasury Regulation 29.2. On the basis of key performance measures and indicators set out in that shareholder compact, the SOE then prepares a corporate plan, and this is submitted at least 1 month before the commencement of the financial year in terms of the PFMS Section 52. And this basically sets out the implementation details to attain the key performance measures and indicators that are outlined in the compact and in the strategic intent statement. Then the DPE then reviews the SOE performance. One of the key roles of the DPE is to ensure SOE adherence to the agreed objectives. So the DPE has developed what is called the Isibuko dashboard, which is one of the mechanisms for regular reporting by the SOE to the DPE. And we ensure that there's regular reporting so that at the end of the day we're pretty sure what is happening on the SOE side so that any risk, emerging risk may be mitigated. On a quarterly basis, SOEs submit their quarterly reports, and the DPE then assesses those reports. Minister issues investor briefs to the SOE board on emerging SOE performance trends, particularly highlighting the need for corrective action in the event of any deviation from agreed objectives and indicators. This is a new introduction, and the expectation is that the SOEs should respond to all the areas that are highlighted by Minister in that investor brief. There is also the engagement with the SOE at the AGM, and the SOE are expected to report to Parliament to ensure effective parliamentary oversight in terms of PFMA Section 65. I'll leave it to the Isibuko dashboard. This is a web-based business intelligence tool that has been developed to allow for timely reporting and to enable access to information in key areas of performance, mainly financial, operational, capital investment, capitalization, socioeconomic performance, as well as risk. This system ensures that at any one point the department has the right information, performance information, and that it can enable key strategic decisions to be made. The way this system works, it's totally web based. The SOE inputs the data, and from a governance point of view, at the SOE side, there will be a data capturer, and then somebody will then approve that data, and that data is then updated on the dashboard. When the dashboard is updated, the DPE, to ensure integrity of that data, the DPE cannot change that data, because that is actually the SOE's report to the DPE. Or that then the DPE undertakes analysis on the data that has been provided, and then that performance is available by the dashboard.
My apology for interrupting. You've used Acting DG for half of your allocated time on this presentation, extremely important presentation to members. But on your time allocated to yourself, you used half of your time already, and we're not a third through the presentation. Can I ask you just to manage your time presentation? Otherwise, we're not going to get through this and ask and allow sufficient time for questions.
Thank you, Chair. What I'll do is just ask people to be a little briefer, and the slides can be read, and we'll focus just on the key points. What we wanted to raise in the next two slides is the risk process and the way that risk is managed with respect to the SOE. There's quite a comprehensive risk process. It's focused on the likelihood of a risk and its potential impact, the likelihood being the likelihood that a risk will occur, and the impact in terms of its severity on the organization, the SOE as a whole. What we do is we ask the SOE to populate their risks on the dashboard, and you can see the top 10 risks, and we've used as an example here Transnet. So the top 10 SOE risks are identified as revenue, capital investment, and regulation, for example, and you can go down the list. We then in turn work with the SOE and identify how we identify the top 10 risks for the same SOE. And those are plotted on the respective graphs on the right-hand side in terms of the impact that they would have on the organization and the likelihood. Obviously, the further they are towards the top right-hand side of the quadrant of each of these graphs, the more significant they are, and the impact they would have on the organization would be most severe. So you can see from our analysis at the bottom, that small blue circle, which is at the top right-hand corner, is tariff regulation. We would see this as having a very severe impact on Transnet business, and its likelihood being quite significant.
I think the key thing, point to take away from the slide is a procurement process that has the objective of leveraging supplier development and development in the supply chain is profoundly different from a normal transactional procurement. So in order to get the competitive supplier development program properly entrenched, we've developed a comprehensive policy that embodies a complete re-engineering of the procurement capability in the organization. As you can see, you move from strategy to policy to organization to process to governance and controls, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got this policy where the SOEs are completely re-engineering their procurement process to align themselves with the objectives of supplier development and localization. Next slide. The key point of a fleet procurement, the 15-year procurement, is to enable the state-owned enterprises to undertake procurements that go beyond the capabilities of their balance sheets and have impacts that impact on the broader economy. And to do this, the essence of the policy is to set up a series of milestones that are overseen by two committees, a developmental committee made up of government and a commercial committee, that ensures that the developmental committee ensures that the developmental objectives of these big strategic fleet procurements are thoroughly integrated into the procurement process at each stage as a way of managing the risks and of ensuring that the impacts will be achieved.
everything goes through the board induction process. The board induction process is intended to equip the SAE board directors with the knowledge, skills, and understanding of each of the SAEs and the government ownership expectations. What we found is that board members, even those that have experience of board management in the private sector, may not be a fait with the processes that we set in place for governance, as well as the requirements, particularly of the PFMA. So we design an induction process which is focused on the unique nature of each of the SOEs, the role of the shareholder, the strategic intent statement that is set for the SOE, and we identify through this process the key elements that we would expect the board to focus on in the forthcoming year, and we use that as an induction process going forward. Then we'll deal with the next slide, which is skills management.
Thank you, Chair. The DP Skills Development Unit was established in 2008 with special focus on the artisan development related to the infrastructure investment programs. But over time, the mandate has been expanded. Currently, the unit oversees implementation of internal skills, SOE skills development to ensure that the SOE participates in initiatives to support the national skills development agenda and ensure that scarce and critical skills are defined in shareholder context and monitored on the dashboard that was mentioned earlier on, and ensures increased skills collaboration across DPSOEs, because in certain instances, we try to avoid SOEs working in silos. And then to promote and coordinate optimal utilization of SOE training facilities to contribute to additional artisan training for national pool, because currently SOEs, because of commercialization, are focusing on their own internal needs, but they have facilities, but we are working on a process to ensure that they train for the nation. And part of the mandate is to solicit funding from the Department of Higher Education National Skills Fund and CITAS to fund in training of additional artisan trainees for the national pool. And secondly, it monitors SOE supplier network skill development related to infrastructure investment programs and maintenance programs through the dashboard. This is related to the competitive supplier, in the main competitive supplier development programs. And lastly, it facilitates partnerships with state-owned enterprises, higher education department, and CITAS, the National Business Initiative, FET colleges, and relevant stakeholders to collaborate on initiatives to maximize and support artisan training to increase the national pool of artisans. Thank you.
The next slides then deal with Transnet and demonstrate how the different areas that have been dealt with in the earlier part of the presentation are translated in the Transnet environment. So on the first slide, I think the key takeaway from the slide is that at the core of Transnet's mandate is competitiveness, improving the competitiveness of this country. So what's in the block there is what appears in the compact in the main Transnet master system, lowering the cost of doing business in South Africa in all facets. But it must be efficient at doing that, and it must do that within the acceptable benchmark standards. So in terms of the mandate and the strategic intent, it now starts being focused on key areas that would like management and the board to focus on. The six areas, really, if I can just highlight the core sentences there, the first one is efficiency. We'd like to see that the investments that are put down by Transnet are used effectively, asset utilization is up. But also we'd like to see a culture of performance in Transnet. We'd like to see a sustainable capital investment approach. We wouldn't want to have a situation where an SOE invests and then collapses after that. Over time, we'd like to have a sustainable Transnet. And therefore, this requires appropriate levels of gearing. The third one there is that even the investments that you've put down, they must translate into tangible improvements in transport services. Here we're talking the procurement of the locomotives and the cranes must translate into improvements in reliability. Crane moves per hour must improve in the ports.
so that we see that what has been invested actually is translating into value for the economy. And then I won't go through all of them, but really it starts talking about what's taking place in the sector, that is like Transnet, to work with government, with the policy departments in meeting the policy and regulatory challenges. We've had some regulatory challenges, particularly in the pipeline sector. I would like to see more of the regulatory decisions aligned to government objectives in terms of making sure that we get that sustainable infrastructure. But then, of course, Transnet is also a key participant in the MTSF Outcome 6, as you know it, in ensuring that the country has a responsive economic infrastructure that meets the needs of this growing economy. And Transnet is part of the stakeholder that includes DPE, DOT, DTAT, Treasury, all the government departments in the infrastructure development cluster. Most importantly, we realize that Transnet cannot fund all this on its own, but and at the same time, that we need to bring in some private sector involvement to enhance the service offering of Transnet. Here you could think about the branch lines, for instance, that bringing in private operators in the branch line network will assist in servicing those customers in the outlying branch line areas who naturally would, you know, have a erratic service offered by Transnet, mainly because the bulk of the services in those areas require shunting and that. The current business model or operating philosophy of TFR, Transnet Frederick, is such that it's much more geared as a hub-to-hub service. Here we start showing how the oversight that we have over Transnet as the team in DPE. This slide shows at group level what we're looking at. We're looking at their operating expenditure. We're monitoring that, and we've got targets and unit of measures that we use. We want to see that they do spend on infrastructure. As we know, we need to put on infrastructure to be able to meet the demand that's required by the sector or customers. But most importantly is that we need to monitor that the people that are actually doing the job are skilled people and we develop skills, but we also have safe operations. So this is at group level. The next slide shows TFR, where we start drilling down into the core of the business. We start looking at whether TFR is growing market share. How are they utilizing the assets? Are they turning around the wagons within the allocated time? What is their safety record? Are they reliable? Do they meet their on-time departure types and on-time arrival? And then we segment these into the different segments in TFR, the heavy haul lines, coal and iron ore, and GFB, mainly in the bulk sector, and then we look at containers as well. I think for me, most importantly, under market share, containers, the percentage of available maritime containers is most important for us because this starts dealing with the issue of containers that arrive at the ports on road and have to queue all the way outside Bay Head. Okay. As I've alluded before, Transnet is investing in infrastructure. Over the past 5 years, Transnet has spent approximately over 70 billion on capex, and in the next 5 years, we're looking at 93 billion, and this excludes capitalized borrowing costs. In terms of the capital investment itself, I think it's important to also make the point that it's not just about making the investment. It's also about making sure that you make the right investment and that you monitor the cost, your cost of that investment. So as a result, as part of it, Transnet also undertakes extensive capital scrubbing to prioritize the timing of certain investments. We've just been through a recession. I think we're coming out of it. But through that time, Transnet has had to continue to invest, but has had to reprioritize some projects to be able to meet all deadlines. And then, of course, the investment program itself will have significant provincial impacts. You can see the provinces, that the bar graph shows the provinces and the impact on each of the provinces. So, essentially, significant benefits accrue to the Northern Cape. As you know, that's where the Sishen Saldanha line is, KZN and Mpumalanga and the Eastern Cape. And then on the table, at the bottom, you can see the employment creation. Now, I must say here that this is based on the provincial GDP figures. So what it's basically saying is, what is the impact of transnational investment on that particular province and the jobs that will come out of that? So at the end of it, and I think I also need to state that this is based on the 80 billion investment program at the time. It's now 93. It has increased. So at the time, the 80 billion would have translated into over 500,000 jobs by 2018. Onto the skills, this slide demonstrates the different areas and facilities that Transnet has and the training that it undertakes. Each of the divisions in the main develop skills in their core area of business. We've got the School of Ports in both NP and TPT, and the School of Rail, which trains drivers and also trains in yard operations, the shunting that I was referring to, the School of Pipelines, and the School of Engineering. And then you can see all the details there on what's happening in this area. I think the two bullet points on the slide at the bottom speak to the accreditation of these training facilities, and you can see that the trade test centers are also fully accredited with TITA. We've spoken about CSDP, and this is Transnet's contribution to the CSDP. Thus far, Transnet has secured three major CSDP transactions, a spare part to the value of 550 million. 50 like new locomotives and the General Electric 100 locomotives that will be produced. But essentially, the important aspect of CSDP for Transnet is that it starts to contribute to localizing local manufacturing and assembly of locomotives in South Africa. You know that over the time that we haven't had investment in this environment by government and by SOEs, is that some industries have actually, you know, they've gone down to the point where suppliers lost business and they had to close shop. This is beginning to bring back some of those suppliers and in this particular case in the rail environment. And these are significant investments that are being made where South African companies will have an opportunity to contribute in this environment and develop their companies and their supplier capabilities, competitive supply capabilities. I think it's most important, not just for the sake of you supplying spare parts or a particular part. It must be a competitive, because we want to be competitive. Just before I move off that slide, on the side there you've got that block with the three bullet points, and the last one there, I think is most important to demonstrate how the procurement is undertaken. In that Transnet Rail Engineering procures from the original equipment manufacturers like the GE and the various suppliers in South Africa to provide local suppliers with access into the global supply chain. This is the last slide on Transnet. It basically shows you the extent to which Transnet spends on BBBE suppliers, and as you can see, it's significant. I won't really say much on it, but you can see the achievements on Transnet part. Most importantly, they spent 13 billion, which accounts for 65% of total procurement spend against the target of 665. Yeah. That's it.
How long do we have?
Can I just say your time is up?
Okay.
But let's make a deal. Transnet appeared before this committee last week. So I'm in your hands how much time you need for the remaining slides. But I think you can conclude.
Okay. So I think I'll probably take about 6 minutes, 6.5. look, if we just start, the strategic mandate is very important because that's where everything flows from. In ESCO's case, when we've had the annual report presentation last week, they still have a strategic mandate to focus on all aspects of electricity provision, generation, transmission, distribution, and retail. Our principal objectives for them, which they need to look at, are catalyzing economic growth, but to ensure that this is accompanied by creation of jobs, and also look at local manufacturing capability, the ECSDP, specifically given the magnitude of their bulk program. Next slide, please. There are four really focused areas that we say must guide ESCOM. They must ensure reliable supply of electricity to all South Africans, and that's within the areas of supply. They must ensure they contribute to the adequate future electricity supply of South Africa. This has changed given the impending IRP, where ESCOM is not the sole provider of generating capacity anymore in South Africa, or what they used to call the supply of last resort. And then ensuring a sustainable business. If it's not sustainable, it can't do the things it needs to do. Next slide, please. If we just look at the shareholder compact, and this is the KPIs in the compact. The compact is a little bit wider, but the KPIs are the ones that are published. And you'll see what we've done is, under operational efficiency, we've introduced the water usage KPI this year, which, because water usage is so important. Some important ones also under this are debt equity and interest cover ratio. Those are very much guided by what the regulator approves in its determination. Now, you'll see in the past years, interest cash cover has been below 1, which shows you that the business is not sustainable. Given the current increases, we feel ESCOM can achieve an interest cash cover of 1 this year, which is the minimum. We have long-term targets, and the long-term target for cash cover is 3, which is really what is required by ratings agencies. We've allowed them to go up to a debt-equity ratio of 2.5 in the current year because they'll be acquiring a lot of debt, but the target there is around 2, which is also required for an investment-grade rating. The rest of the stuff, I think there's a lot of training targets, et cetera, and they did go through that in the annual report presentation last week. One very important, if we can just go back, is the energy efficiency, the DSM, 994 gigawatt hours. Given that we know that there may be some pressure on energy provision in the next year or so, that is about 1 terawatt hour, which is just under 0.5% of what ESCOM provides, supplies to the country. And we're talking about needing to increase that by about 6 times if that is to cater if we don't put any additional generation in for the next year or so. Next slide, please. Okay, so ESCOM plans to invest a lot of money in capital assets over the next 5 years, and this is just ESCOM. I mean, obviously, there are private sector investors also that will be coming in. ESCOM spent more than $150 billion on CapEx over the last 5 years, and if you go into the annual report, you'll see it ramped up. It was in the sort of 20, 30 billion range and went up to 88, and then obviously it had to slow down a bit given their cash flow constraints. They're looking at the next 5 years of about $250 billion that they need to spend. The big projects are really Madupi and Kusile, which are coal-fired six-pack power stations. Ingula, the pump storage, and then there's Syria, which is wind and CSP, which was required by the World Bank loan. Important, though, is that it's not just generation. We've got transmission capital projects, such as the Cape Grid, the Northern Grid, Southern and Western Cape, and they have spoken last week about the Cape Grid, is that that required a lot of strengthening. You remember when Kuberg had some of those problems, and there were issues about transferring enough capacity down to the coast. And also, if you look on the right-hand side, ESCOM has trained about 438 procurement and supply chain people for 2.6 days of service per year. The thing with that is that with the magnitude of the procurement that ESCOM is doing, if they don't have properly capacitated procurement people, it costs us a lot more, and it's not done properly. So that is an area they've identified and they've started strengthening. And they target to have at least 50% of local content in their new build contracts, and that's also part of their compact. Next slide, please.
slide. I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, but these are the major projects on the generation side. You can see there are GDP impacts. What he said is that the two coal-fired and the one pump storage station has a 0.7% impact on GDP, a positive impact per year. But I think also what's important is that for the local area where that project is located, the impacts are much greater. And just that one on Madupi there, it says 1,900, it should be 19,000 jobs. These are estimates of jobs. And on the bottom right, sort of, what's it, block, there's a lot of other things that happen. You don't just build a power station. You know, you've got catering, laundry. We heard about the food parcels last week, the security, all these types of things that also need to be done. Next slide, please. This is just a breakdown of the previous slide. What we're saying is if you take those three projects and you add up all the various, and we've broken down the estimated jobs per category, direct and indirect, and then you use a multiplier of four for those three projects, we're saying about 160,000 people are directly impacted by those projects. And then you've also got your, these are just for generation, then you've also got your transmission projects and the return to service, which are those three power stations that are almost back in service that were mothballed previously. We're talking about another sort of 11,000 jobs there. Next slide, please. We do place great emphasis on what ESCOM does with skills, and they've invested about 780 million in the last financial year on skills. They've got 24 facilities nationally and 530 practitioners. I'm always amazed when you look through ESCOM's list of the jobs that exist in the company, what people you have that they employ. And I said, but these are not some of the more funny ones. And they've got an academy of learning with the divisional MDs, a very high level that actually oversee that, which is at their college in Midrand. And they've got over 5,000 learners in their pipeline, and 4,000 of those are technical people. Next slide, please. ESCOM also leverages on its suppliers in terms of training people, and they've delivered about 6,000. The numbers are committed are about 6,000, and they've delivered about 3,000 of those already. And a lot of that is in sort of the, I guess, the artisan-type area, welders, boilermakers, riggers, and that is the stuff that we will need to be able to build the infrastructure as we go forward. Next slide. I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but this is just to show that from the build program, these are the types of things that have been established. Just, for example, the Hitachi boiler contract. They spent about $900 million in facilities and training in South Africa, and there's a boiler pressure part workshop, which is in Nigel, that is already in operation, and then some of the others which you can read from the slide. And then just in terms of their BE, about $70 billion per year that they spent, and you can see the percentages there, $20 billion in the last financial year, and the year before, $46 billion of that was spent on BE. 2008 was measured. That's it. Thank you. I know that was 6 or 7 minutes.
That was 8 and a half. Presenters, thank you to the presenters from DPE. Members, we have this presentation in front of us. Extremely important, the shareholder oversight, including the SOE impact. Can I have an indication whether you want to ask questions on this presentation now, or alternatively, we can take the presentation on the annual report, which is more lengthy, but the main business of the day. Can I have an indication whether you want to field questions now or whether we ask the department to present the annual report as well and then holistically take questions?
Chairperson, I propose to the committee that we listen them up, the whole presentation, and then we can ask questions, because maybe in the presentation that will follow, some of our questions that we got in mind will be answered. Thank you.
That is a general feeling? Can we ask then just to note your questions and just keep it to one side? Dr. Shaw, over to you for the annual report presentation. Can you just give us again an indication? You said 35 to 40 minutes. As you know, the committee has time to listen.
Okay. Chair, I realize the time has been taken very seriously, so if I can ask my team to work through it quite rapidly. There's more slides, but it is actually easier to present this particular presentation, so we'll try and do it as rapidly as possible. There's a lot of slides in the finances at the end, towards the end of the presentation, and I'll try to cut down the talking time in that respect, because a lot of the information is already there.
What this presentation will focus on is the 2009-2010 key achievements. So we're quite well into the 2010 year. There's some achievements which we don't mention which are really attached to this financial year as opposed to the previous one. We'll look at the organizational structure, HR statistics. We'll go through each of the programs against the business plan that was put forward for that 2009-2010 year. And then we'll highlight some of the financial statements. I think one of the key elements from our perspective is that we had an unqualified audit for this department yet again, and I'd like to thank the people from our department, right across the department, for being able to provide us with that. It's a key achievement for us. Just some of the key achievements that we have as an overall introduction is that we've been able to refine our strategic mandate and our intent. I think what I've tried to indicate previously is we focused a lot more on improving the governance processes within the department and with respect to the SOEs. We strengthened board composition. We've introduced a lot of portfolio level monitoring. We're in the process of revisiting a number of the guidance documents that we issue. We've focused on the South African Power Project. There's been a lot of extensive work done in energy because of the constraints that we face as a country. A lot of the department's time has been spent in that area. The Competitive Supplier Development Program I won't go into because we've, in the previous presentation, given you quite a clear sense of where we are at with that program. And that program promises to be something quite substantial as it grows bigger and bigger. In terms of the West African cable system, we've signed off some of the agreements around that in 2009, towards the end of 2009. The logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation framework, which essentially is the process under which we do our governance, and there's one key slide in the previous presentation which shows you how we do that. It starts with the strategic intent statement. We've really improved that, and we've aligned the dashboard against that very clearly so that we have a very clear process of monitoring that process. The Infraco WAC supply contract is in force. The nuclear education course was completed. 60 billion subordinated loan was approved, and government guarantees of 176 billion were secured for Eskom. Now, I must add, this was at the end of that financial year. There has been further work in this area in this new financial year. Transfer of the hospital in Alexander Bay to province. And this is a point where I hand over to Shireen, if we can just go through some of the HR areas and also the structure of the department.
Sure, thank you. This slide really focuses on the structure of the department in terms of our reporting lines. Nothing much has changed. We reflect the minister, the deputy minister, and the director general, with the department under the director general and the various sectors reporting into the DG. With regard to capacity in the department, we more or less remained average on around about 165 on the establishment. We've got, at the end of March 2010, we had 140 people employed in DPE, with vacancies sitting at 28. It's been a challenging year regarding our vacancies, with some key positions not being filled as quickly as we'd like it to. You all know that we still have the Director General position, which has been vacant for a while, but we're moving quite as briskly as we can with regard to that. And perhaps our minister would like to just comment on that a bit later. We've appointed 15 people for the year ending March 2010, and we've had vacancies as well. Next slide, thank you. With regard to employment equity, which we are required to report on, I think the most important takeaway here is at SMS level, we're required to have a 50-50 target in terms of male-female. At the end of March 2010, we were sitting at 53.3 male and 46.7 female. Our current stats, we've gone up. We are 51 male and 49 female, which is an achievement for the department. Also, with regard to disability stats, DPSA requires us to have at least 2% of our establishment filled by disabled people. We're currently at 4.28% with 6 people in the department with disabilities, and we continue to watch that statistic quite closely. Thank you.
Moving on to programs of performance, starting with administration, and we'll just start with investment and portfolio management. We talked about the development of the logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation framework. Guidelines were developed in and associated calendar was also developed in that regard. Guidelines also for the SOE corporate plan format and content, just to guide the SOEs in preparation of the corporate plan to show minimum levels of information that the SOE should provide in their corporate plan. Then the SOE dashboard, there has been further developments and enhancements to that dashboard, and certain more areas have been included in the performance reporting through the dashboard. This covers CSDP, the skills, the property disposals, guarantees, just to ensure that the continuous liability is also, we're monitoring that. Then on a quarterly basis, we have what we term the DPE board meeting, which basically reviews the performance of the SOE, and out of that meeting, investor briefs are then prepared and these are communicated to the DPE, as was alluded to earlier. We've also developed a risk management framework, and we do hold workshops to identify and prioritize the shareholder risk. One of the things that we also set out to do was to develop a quantitative capital structure decision-making framework that would enable to ensure that we had a concise methodology for assessment of the capital requirements of the SOE. This model was developed, and SAA Transnet and DNEL capital evaluation was completed. The model was also utilized in the SAFCO dividend assessment, as well as the ESCOM funding assessment. As we were doing that work, we discovered that the National Treasury was also developing a similar capital structure framework. And we've been working since with the National Treasury to ensure that there's no duplication of effort. We also developed a guarantee and share office guidelines that basically sets out the framework for issuing guarantees, monitoring and reporting of those guarantees, shareholder agreements, and just to ensure that effective management of these instruments, particularly the contingent liability of government. In terms of SOE MTF applications, those applications, Alexco, PBMR, and now were made during that year. And then a study was undertaken of the different possibilities for facilitating infrastructure funding required by the SOE, just to see what available models were there, and to have a clear understanding of the advantages and disadvantages of each in relation to each of the SOE. We had set out to undertake a study of the regulatory frameworks employed for the infrastructure investment in order to determine the most appropriate approach and team interventions. At the close of 2009-10, this hadn't been completed, and we have now done call for proposals, and we will be appointing a service provider. A lot of work in CIPM is around transaction advice and input on financial, legal, and governance issues relating to SOE. And a number of transactions outlined there were executed during 2009-10. Then in relation to planning, monitoring, and evaluation in administration, the business and strategic plan were approved, and quarterly reports and the end of the year report was completed.
working with the ICT broadband area. Annual assessments, those are the corporate plans and annual reports. Those were completed as planned. The shareholder compact for InfraCo. We put that concluded in June because the target was April, but we did that in June. Achievement of MTEF targets by Broadband InfraCo, and those are the monthly, quarterly, and annual monitoring reports, and those are processed. The international submarine cable is progressing well. The cable has been manufactured, and they're about to commence the rollout into the ocean. There are some challenges around pricing, given what's happened with the environment of late in that area. Assessing the impact of InfraCo on broadband pricing in South Africa, we've done that analysis, and I think everybody does know broadband prices came down by about 73% within the last 2 years, year and a half or so. And then also expanding the ICT infrastructure in South Africa, and there we're talking about InfraCo's terrestrial network, and there we do a quarterly assessment on that. Next slide, please. On the energy side, which is really Eskom, monitoring their capacity expansion program, so we track their procurement, the delivery of the new build on a monthly basis, and there were interventions that they have done to prevent delays, but obviously they have also indicated that there's certain delays that they haven't been able to mitigate. Also, an issue that we looked at was the funding of the Kusile power station. A framework has been proposed and is in the process of being finalized. The EDI, or distribution infrastructure here in South Africa, is very important, and Eskom has programs in place to assist municipalities, and we are asking them to strengthen what they do in that area. The appointment of the CEO and chairman, this was initiated and concluded in this financial year. PBMR, Nuclear Enterprises, the rationalization, a lot of meetings, monthly meetings held, progress on restructuring. There was a business case that was approved in the last financial year based on the PBMR participation in the U.S. Next Generation Nuclear Plant Program, but obviously that has moved, and things have changed as we've moved into this financial year.
With respect to the legal and governance support provided to the department and to the SOE team, the first issue is around the transfer of Telkom shares, which were previously held in the Diabo Trust, which expired. The key issues to highlight around the achievements were that the trustees accepted the indemnity that's in the trust deed, and they also then subsequent to that agreed to transfer the trust assets. Most of these assets are shares, and the department then appointed a service provider who would then warehouse the shares on behalf of trust beneficiaries. And then we also appointed the steering committee around the process on tracing the outstanding beneficiaries so that we can then transfer the shares that we've received from the trust. And then with respect to Aventura, which is no longer trading, and we're in the process of finalizing the closure of that SOE. The key achievements are that we received and audited financial statements for the years from 2004 to 2008, and we appointed service providers to conduct the due diligence on the properties that are owned by Aventura to assist us to prepare an asset register for the company. And we also commence the process of transferring one of the outstanding properties, which is Plattenberg Bay, to Forever Resorts, which was the successful buy of the last tranche of assets. With request to support provided to the Eskom team, we negotiated and advised on the Eskom Guarantee Framework Agreement, which would then regulate the relationship between government and Eskom around the guarantees that would be granted to Eskom to assist them in raising funding for the build program. This agreement was executed by the three parties, which is the Minister of Finance and Eskom. We also provided inputs around the constitutional amendments relating to the establishment of the rates. We negotiated together with Eskom the African Development Bank loan, and as well as the guarantee, which was signed by the Minister and the Minister of Finance. And then the support provided to Broadband InfraCo related largely to the ECMS licenses. And in this regard, we interacted with ICASA as well as with the DOC quite extensively around the grant of that license. And then the support that the legal support provided to the transit team related largely to the issues under the National Port Act on the corporatization of the NPA, as well as disputes around port limits, and those were resolved successfully. And then litigation under Transnet, the key litigation was Umthunzi and Transnet, and government was a party, joined as a party, and that matter was settled out of court. And then with regard to Londoloza Power Pool, previously in this litigation, we had been successful on appointing Limine and got a constitutional court judgment in our favor, but the plaintiffs then issued new summons. And the key issue in the last year was to get the plaintiffs to amend their particulars of claim, but they failed to meet their prescribed deadlines. With regard to support provided to the PBMR team, we provided preliminary inputs and comments on draft agreements, and then this transaction didn't proceed as it was superseded by the restructuring of PBMR. And around the governance support provided to the department, we commenced with the governance audit, particularly around the subsidiaries that are owned by the SOEs, and just got a sort of clear view and regulation of those subsidiaries. We advised the minister and the SOE teams around the composition of SOE boards and the terms of those board members. We reviewed and advised on the SOE governance systems on the dashboard. We conducted the SAA board induction. We also finalized and updated remuneration guidelines, which were approved by the minister. We also prepared terms of reference for the appointment of the advisor to provide secretarial services to the remuneration panel. We also prepared and appointed the service providers to assist on comparing the Companies Act and the PFMA for governance purposes to align the legislative compliance of SOEs. And we also approved the terms of reference for, we developed terms of reference which were approved for the Oversight Committee on SOE's review. And then we also prepared a board database framework. Further governance support included assisting SOE teams around the AGMs and the board appointments, and then advising on the performance assessment for the boards of some of the SOEs that are listed there. We also prepared CEO appointment guidelines, as well as board performance evaluation questionnaires and framework. Thank you.
With program for manufacturing, starting with this defense, one of the key things was to get that alignment between DNL's business strategy with the DOD's strategic requirements. Some progress has been made, but this is contingent upon the DOD finalizing its military strategy. We understand that this process is well advanced, and we're working very closely with the DOD in this respect. So in relation to that, that also has an impact on that retention of the strategic and sovereign capabilities in areas agreed with the DOD. That alignment should be done once that military strategy is finalized by the DOD. Then there was the concept and scoping of initiatives to improve DNL's industrial impact and deepening of local supply chains. Going concern challenges facing DNL made it difficult for the SOE to leverage its capability on industrial impact. However, DNL continued to strive to achieve over 50% local content in its local supply chain. That go to finalize the proposal with the Chartered Institute of Procurement Secretaries wasn't achieved, but this has to do with procurement, and we're looking at aligning this to the CSDP rather. Dinel's financial situation remains precarious, so it is still dependent on government guarantees to back its borrowing, and 1.3 billion government guarantees were rolled over in March 2010, and further 550 million was approved. And this expired and was rolled over in July 2010. No capitalization was made to Dinel during this period, but Dinel has been requested to come up with a robust turnaround plan. The biggest challenge in Dinel right now, there has been improvement in most of Dinel's business units. The biggest challenge right now that remains is the Dinel Sub Aerostructures subsidiary, and this has been affected very, very, very badly by the delays in the 400M contract that has had a material impact on that business. DSA is basically modeled around supplying certain components to the 400M aircraft, and all those delays have had a debilitating impact on that business. During 2009-10, strategic diligences were done on petroleum metal sources as well as Dinel Dynamics. A PFMA application for Dinel Dynamics missiles on the equity partnership with a global OEM was processed, and approval was granted subject to certain conditions being met. Intergovernmental consultations to find a workable solution to the definition of the national strategic capability are continuing. In relation to that position paper and implementation plan for the landward consolidation, there were some difficulties in reaching consensus with industry players on this proposal, but now has gone public with a request for information, which will then be followed by a request for proposals. Intergovernmental consultations continue, And this comes back to that definition of the national strategic capability requirements. So that alignment on roles and responsibilities in marketing Dinel capabilities and products is contingent on finalization of that national strategic capability. KPI has been agreed with Dinel, and these are included in the shareholder compact. In terms of the year-on-year improvement in profit margins, this was not entirely achieved. There was some improvement at the gross profit margin, but there's still challenges in that for a manufacturing company like Dinel, you really require it to be around to have a gross margin of about 25%. Right now, there has been some improvement from about 16 to 18, but that challenge is still there. But that was also hampered by the economic slowdown in the industry. Dinel set itself a triple BE rating of 5 in this financial year, and that was achieved. And then, in relation to the board, the Dinel board, a skills assessment was undertaken, and a new board is in place with the right skills.
and I'm not even sure whether you would be available. I wonder if you wouldn't present this side on the staff call.
Thanks, Andrew. Very briefly, both the annual assessment, staff call, shareholder compact, and monthly, quarterly, and annual monitoring requirements were all finalized and completed. And an application for a fiber project was rejected. Program 5 is Transport Enterprises, Transnet, SAA, and South African Express. On Transnet, on the Nuha container terminal, we developed and forwarded a framework for the transaction to the Department of Transport. At the same time, we also requested the Transnet board to follow up on the transaction structure. The transaction itself will be undertaken by the National Ports Authority in terms of their responsibilities in the National Ports Act. And on the branch lines, we finalized the draft, the branch line strategy jointly with DOT and Transnet in December 2009. And a branch line entity was established within Transnet Freight Rail. We've also identified potential concessions on the branch lines, and the 9 phase 1 concessions on the branch lines, as agreed by ourselves, DOT, and Transnet. Then on the National Corridor Performance Measurement Project, which is essentially monitoring and measuring operational performance on strategic corridors, we initiated the IT system implementation on the different corridors. We also, undertook a quarterly assessment of the Transnet CAPEX and also identified CSDP opportunities in Transnet. This assessment of CSDP opportunities was completed in September 2009. In the aviation sector, in terms of the African aviation strategy by SAA and SACS, SAA launched 3 new routes, and SACS entered into a joint venture with the, in the Congo, Congo Express, in the DRC. We also assessed the airline's plans, which were reviewed as part of the corporate plan review. But we did not manage to develop a financial model that would have assisted us with the scenario planning and forecasting in the airline environment as it pertains to SAA and SACS. This project has been carried over into the new financial.
I'm sorry, Shabazan, can you call it SACS?
SACS. Yes, thank you.
Sound like you're out of order.
Okay. Okay, I think fortunately there's no more facts on this one. We worked with SAA on a process to create Voyager as a profit center, and on South African on that we appointed consultants that would advise on the viability of South African Airways Technical as a multi-airline focused maintenance hub. With regard to the joint project facility, we've established a dashboard for the CSDP. Foundry and steel construction firms were benchmarked, training was undertaken, and 125 opportunities were identified. 15 agencies and programs were linked to suppliers. With regard to setting up the CSDP process flow for the departments and broader application across the SOE, we've developed a draft transactional policy, and key elements of a programmatic policy have been developed. A position paper on leveraging procurement across governments has been developed and relevant stakeholder engagement undertaken. The locomotive fleet procurement process has been launched. DPE's
position on supply development, its incorporation into industrial policy was completed, and engagements with private sector companies took place. This indicated support for CSDP. With regard to training, boot camps have taken place in ESCOM and Transnet. Both SOE have produced 5-year supply development plans, which have received ministerial approval, and they're now in the implementation phase. An e-learning procurement capability program has also been developed, and some research was completed to inform the SDPs. A nuclear education course was completed for review. Work was carried out in support of the IMC process on a nuclear work program. An ESCOM study was expanded to include a range of procurement issues pertinent to government. And a renewables and industrial policy initiative was established. First phase was completed and a second phase has been launched. Engagements have taken place with the UK and Germany. With regard to the regional supplier development program, which is in essence the regional components of the CSDP in Africa, agreements with 4 out of 5 host institutions have been established, and the relevant technology platform has been put in place. This essentially will link and matchmake buyers with suppliers. And a survey has started in Uganda, Tanzania, Zambia, and Kenya. Intergovernmental negotiations took place in Mozambique and Botswana on intergovernmental consensus on rail and power projects, and obviously related to that, efforts to facilitate the signing of power purchase agreements regionally. With regard to human resources and capacity building, a skills dashboard has been completed. SOE reporting takes place on a quarterly basis. And DPE participates in a multi-stakeholder artisan program to support learner placements by both state-owned enterprises and suppliers. And reports on the analysis of the further education and training programs against the electrical and welding trades qualifications were completed. Terms of reference have been completed for worst case experiential guidelines, and the guidelines have been approved. With regard to DPE solar water heater skills development program, a national installers training plan was completed. This included qualification registration to incorporate solar water heater installation and maintenance, and also training center preparedness. Materials were developed and materials were finalized and developed, including visual and audio aids for electric learners. We've identified the numbers of installers, semi-skilled, skilled, and unskilled workers for this sector. And with regard to DPE's management learning program and autumn school, a DPE UCT MOU was concluded, course content was developed, and a draft reader was completed. And an autumn school was hosted in August 2009. With regard to aerostructures and oversight of a turnaround plan for DSA, a strategic framework for joint operations was developed. A joint business plan between DSA and AeroSud was also developed, and financial models attached to this were completed, and the initial funding requirements for DSA was also completed. With regard to technology and innovation and the ICT marine cable, the framework for the assessment of SOE innovation was developed. But it hasn't been applied across the SOE. And final version of the agreement relating to Infraco's participation in WACS was completed, and the WAC supply contract is in force. With regard to the DPE's property project, Transnet's second non-core list was submitted and approval was granted for that list. Key state transactions and relevant facilitation was undertaken with key stakeholders. A property dashboard was developed and refined to monitor the disposals. And a government shared services utilization project was initiated. It's still in its infancy, but it looks to share servitudes amongst utilities and agencies across South Africa to reduce red tape. With regard to Alex Core, transfers, town planning information gathering and consolidation was completed. With regard to environmental issues, DPE has a project that seeks to streamline environmental impact assessments for strategically important developments, primarily related to Eskom and Transnet build programs. A DPE DEA, Department of Environmental Affairs, and Eskom MOU was signed. A dashboard was also developed for monitoring the EIA's efforts. An SOE fund has been established, and the fund disbursements and their usage is monitored on a quarterly basis. And we facilitate SOE contributions. This is to assist DEA in processing applications more speedily. And we completed a position paper on climate change and participate in the Intergovernmental Climate Change Forum.
Chair, if I could just highlight some of the key financial issues. There's a number of slides here which go into some detail. I won't spend a lot of we received an unqualified audit for the 2009-10 year. There was an emphasis of matter, but I must say that the emphasis of matter was pertinent to all government departments that represented their financials, and it really relates to the basis of accounting that is used rather than any other particular matter that has been picked up. If we go to the expenditure trends, the following table provides a comparator between the 2008-09 financial year and the 2009-10 financial year. And roughly the structure of our expenditure is the same. It's just very marginally higher, generally as a consequence of inflationary conditions between the 2 years. As you can see there, energy and broadband and transport remain the two largest spending SOEs. When it comes to transfers, you'll see the reason why those amounts are so much larger than in other areas. So I will give you some of the background to that. But essentially, in respect of transport, it is in conversion of a quasi-equity guarantee into full equity. And in the case of energy and broadband, it's in respect of PBMR support that was provided during that particular year. The increase of 722 million in the annual appropriation from 3.3 billion is mainly as a result of the increase in transfer payments, which I will show you, and which really have reduced quite substantially from this financial year going forward. There is some underspending in the department, mainly as a consequence of current expenditure on the operational budget and as a consequence of compensation of employees as a result of some posts not being filled or being vacant for a period of time during the year. This goes into some of the detail. I won't go through exactly what is in the slide. It really deals with the appropriation per economic classification in the annual financial. This is probably quite important, and this relates to the summary of transfer payments. Transfer payments being those payments which the department is responsible for providing as onward payments to the SOEs predominantly. There's some payments in respect of Alex Core. There's payments in respect of broadband and Denel. And then the two large ones are PBMR, the 1.7 billion, and SAA, the 1.549 conversion into equity. That totals 3.8 for this financial year of transfer payments to SAEs. What we now do is go into each one of the programs in detail, and I'm not sure if it's appropriate to go through this, Chair. I'm hoping that I could just show you the structure, and then if there were any questions in respect of any particular program, we could go back and we could look at where the appropriations and the actual expenditure lie. One of the changes that we did have during this financial year is that we had the introduction of a deputy minister, and this caused some additional expenditure in the area of administration. The way we structured these slides is we look at what the focus of this particular program is. So in the case of administration, it provides us overarching management and key supporting functions to the Office of the Director General, as well as corporate services, and as well as the ministry. We then follow on with a review of expenditure trends in this program and the reasons why there may have been changes in respect of expenditure for this particular program. We do the same for energy and broadband, where you get some of the details broken down into the energy, nuclear, ICT, and overall management of this program. And then, then we look at the expenditure in respect of the allocation for this program during 2009-10. So again, legal, governance, and risk. I'll go through each one of these because they're going into an enormous amount of detail. But what we felt was important is to share some of the detail with you, as well as some of the rationale as to why there may be differences in expenditure for each of the programs. So we very clearly state what that difference is in each case. Transport, JPF. And then the last area, which is important to understand, is environment. What this is the adjusted appropriation, and you can see it's based on each of those programs. It gets us to the $3.9 billion that we demonstrated to you previously. The environments are stated in each case. The final appropriation for that year is again restated. And then there's a variance in the final right-hand column. And each one of these is explained in the following two slides. Some of the environments are a result of savings. Some of them are as a consequence of the need to expend greater amounts of money. So there has to be some shifting between these programs as we manage our business plan over the financial year. And so we do this together with Sandy, the CFO, to ensure that ultimately we're managing our expenditure effectively and still achieving on our business plan, which is what we have presented to you previously. Again, this is vital for the different programs. The departmental revenue is basically briefly stated here. I wouldn't be able to go into any of the detail to any extent, but if there are any questions on revenue, I'm sure Sandy Hutchins, our CFO, would be able to deal with some of those. Major expenditure items, this comes down to some of the areas that we spend on: communication, computer services, inventory, operating leases, property and services, travel and subsistence, and then the use of consultants, contractors, and special advisors. So the basic expenditure categories that we have within the department. You can see that the larger amounts of these are made up of travel and subsistence, which is relatively small in comparison to other government departments, even considering our small size, and the use of consultants, contractors, and special advisors, which are also used in quite a limited way in the department, in terms of supporting some of the business plan functions that we demonstrated to you previously. Compensation of employees, again, a comparison from 2009 to the previous year. As Shireen demonstrated to you previously, while we have had some staff leave the department, we've roughly replaced those staff, so we're relatively the same size as we were in the previous year. So what you see here in respect of compensation of employees is largely as a result of increases in salary as a result of agreed SMS increases and inflation. And that's the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Acting DG. Thanks, everybody. Members, this is the time for questions. I need to check with you whether you want to ask your questions
across the two presentations. It might be easier for you to do that. Okay. Thanks. Let me take the list of names. Dr. Gorma. Dr. Mabuela. Dr. Pandey. Dr. Corina. Mrs. Bowman. Salana. Dr. Pandalan. And the chair. Dr. Gorma.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the two presentations by the officials from the department. I need to congratulate, firstly, the department, because the DPE did not occur any unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, or wasteful expenditure. And the Minister, coming from the Portfolio Committee of Finance, knows what achievement that is. So I think it's a good show, and congratulations to the department for that achievement. In the foreword of the Minister, she mentioned the Remuneration Advisory Panel and that the recommendations will be out shortly. That was in the annual report. My question is, when can we expect the recommendations? Secondly, the vacancies was referred to. The acting DG is there for a couple of months already, as well as in a number of SOEs. We have still vacancies, including chairpersons, including CEOs, even on board. So I just want a clarity on what progress are being made, and do we have any time frames to address the vacancies within the department. I want to go to the sub-program on Danel. Now, many of the targets we've seen have not been met within the Danel, and there are two specific business units in Danel that are problematic. The one is Danel Dynamics Missiles, and the department says we are looking at equity partners, which I think is to be welcomed, and I would like to ask what progress has been made. And secondly, the Danel Saab Aerostructures. The department said that government decision is required. I would very much like to know when will this happen, and what are the details. Okay. And then on litigation, there are four lit cases pending, and then there's one new case, the former CEO. Can I ask what progress has been made on the pending cases since the report was published, as well as the new litigation case of the former CEO against the department? Thanks.
Mr. Mokoena?
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to concur with the Honourable Governor about the very comprehensive report, very professional indeed, and also add that we're very proud that you had an unqualified report, audit report. Three quick ones, Chairperson. Number one, I would like to find out, is it a hindrance, the fact that the Department of Mineral Resources determines policy for USRS energy concerned, of energy, sorry, of Department of Energy, that the authority to formulate policy, energy policy, reposes in a different department, and then you kind of subordinate yourself to it, because the implication is also that in terms of our oversight, it means our oversight has got to be affected. I wouldn't say compromised, or say it will be vitiated, because it means there's a Portfolio Committee on Energy that has got to do oversight over that policy. And then this side also has got to do that. This is in particular refers to ESCOM, obviously. ESCOM, what's more called now, they're now going to be following up TBMR as well as Quebec. Well, that's the first one. How does that sit with you? And I think the minister will probably shed more light on that one because it's a quick cabinet decision. But I mean, just doesn't seem to sit very well with us, number one. Number two, we had a joint patrol committee, a meeting with the DOT, Department of Transport, and a number of issues were raised there, particularly affecting Transnet. And the focus was on the rail gauge. DPE had a certain model of the gauge, and the DOT also had another preference. And the significance of this was how to penetrate the rest of the continent because of the lack of congruence in the gauges throughout Africa. Now, if we had been told with two departments that didn't agree on the side of the gauge, that would actually impact on the whole expansion. Now, let's know if to what extent has that been resolved. Finally, Chairperson, the third one, Safcon. You mentioned the fact that there is the fiber application that was declined. If we could just elaborate on that, please. Thanks.
Dr. Van Dijk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to put this question to the Minister. This annual report is about the Minister's first term in office, and it deals with the performance of a department, of which he is responsible now for the Department of Public Enterprises. Chairperson, now it's been said in the presentation that the core function of public enterprises is to provide infrastructure. But it's also been set in the past to defend the existence of public enterprises, that it contributes to the economic development. But over the past year, we experienced that two of the biggest public enterprises, like Transnet and Eskom, do not comply to that. Taking into account that Eskom said about 2 weeks ago that it can only guarantee power supply to South Africa till 2017 due to financial constraints. And the fact that we had a brother fight a short while ago between Department of Transport and Transnet concerning the collapse of the infrastructure of Transnet. I want to know from the Minister, is she satisfied with the performance of public enterprises in this past financial year, taking into account their contribution to economic development? And also, like in the past, been said, public enterprises contributed to employment, whether she's satisfied that they made a contribution to employment, and to allocate the dividends back to the Treasury, and lastly, also their contribution in skills development. Because those are actually over and above the provision of infrastructure. Those are also objectives for the existence of public enterprises, and I wanted to elaborate on that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me first thank the Department for their elaborate presentation and also thank them for the unqualified report, financial report that they got. I've got three questions here. You said four. Okay. In fact, the first one, Chair, will be on the what you call on the InfraCo. Initially applied for two licenses. One is the ECMS, which has been granted, and the second one is the Electronic Communication Service license that will allow InfraCo to enter the telecommunication retail market. The ECS has been a matter of dispute between InfraCo and the Department of Communication. And the absence of the ECS license has compelled InfraCo to enter into an agreement with Neotel. Is InfraCo still going to get the ECS license? that will be the first question. The second one, Chair, will be on the soft call. There is this fiber project that was rejected. I just want to know as to why was it rejected, that the fiber project. And then on the last one, Chair, would be on the Transnet rail, in that they still have to spend on their CAPEX something like 93 billion rand, that is in the next 5 years. Does that also include the expansion of this railway, what do you call it, standard gauge and all that, which was recently published in the newspapers that they want to expand these rails? Are you also going to include that on your CAPEX starting from now to the future? Thank you very much.
Mr. Nana, you next. Sorry. And then I wanted to note any other. Yes, let me get my thing right. Ms. Gloria, then Mr. Nana, then Mr. Van Dalen. Please.
Perhaps if I could just have some clarity, I want to just refer to this report and perhaps see if Ed could help me here. On page on page 94, and this was also revealed in the slide, you have an amount consultants, contractors, etc. for 51 million rand. However, if I turn to page 140, I have a list. Which details the utilization of the consultants, and that amount is referred to here as 25 million. Now that's half. If I could just have some clarity on that. Now relating to that, I want to ask a question just to add on to the vacancy rate, because in your report you also refer in page 124 to the reason for vacancies not filled, and you talk about due to scarce skills. Now, does this relate to your use of consultants, which seems to be fairly a significant amount? And then the other thing, just a smaller item, in your gift donations and so on page 112, you've got an amount there of 678,000 rand. I'd just like to know, and I've been through those, what sort of criteria do you use? Do people just approach you? What approach do you use to issuing out those funds? And then perhaps just a last one. I just want to refer to the comment made about the branch lines with Transnet and the funding, private funding that we're possibly going to be looking for there. As we've travelled around and we've realised, you know, what we need to be developing out in the rural areas, and that's where these branch lines are. So I think my question there would be, the importance that we are placing on that in order for that development to take place. Because I think my understanding in the previous regime, those lines were put in order to deliver the farmers' milk and so on. Now, I think we need that in order to expand our rural development. Thanks,
Chairperson. The first one is a question directed to you. Probably you could respond to it later. I needed to check here because King Juju has just made a pronouncement that one man, one husband, one wife, and all of them. I wanted to check whether will it be part of the discussion documents.
Don't be naughty in the NGC. Don't be naughty.
I wanted to check so that it becomes government policy. Am I out of order?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. No, it's fine, Chef. I'm out of order. What does that mean, Chef? Chef, thanks. The first one really is to join my colleagues in commending TPE for an unqualified audit that they have received. They make us proud. Thank you very much, colleagues. My first question, Chairperson, is around the FOEs and their role in the Dinalid program. I've gone through the report. I know Transnet would, from time to time, in the annual report about their progress and bottlenecks and impact, particularly around your Dinalid program. My understanding is that there was an agreement between TPE and FOEs that each FOE would adopt a province in which they would roll out and provide support insofar as the Dinalid program is concerned. Now, I want to check. I know Transnet is doing good work in the Free State. Some provinces were supposed to have been rolling out this kind of support in other some SOEs were supposed to have rolled out this kind of support in other provinces. I want to check whether TPE is aware of this, and because as far as I know, very little is being done in other provinces, and then what's the plan in trying to ensure that other SOEs indeed play their role in this regard. The second one, Chairperson, is around supplier development program. I accept that TPE has got this noble plan, which has been able to be cascaded to the SOEs. But may I suggest that reality on the ground suggests something different? Are there checks and balances from your side as TPE minister in monitoring that indeed SOEs do stick to your supplier development program? And the third one, Chairperson, which really bothers me is the transformation rate in some of our SOEs. I mean, I will not mention the name of the SOE, but you will remember the first annual report we received. There were serious problems with the transformation pace. It was actually appalling to say the least. And I would recall sometime last year when Dinel came to present the annual report. And last year it was Dinel. I mean, their transformation figures were also appalling. Now I want to ask the department whether this year has there been any improvements? And lastly, Chairperson, consultants and advisors. Mrs. Bowman mentioned 51 million. Indeed, it's in the presentation, which is a lot of money. But can I check how many of those consultants, contractors, and advisors were once in your employ as members of your staff before?
Let me just check with TPE and yourself, sir. The Dinalid project that I know of is the Math and Science project of Department of Education, and you have related it to Transnet. Can I just check? I understand you're talking about the same thing, whether Transnet has got a link with that program, and DCE therefore will know if that is the other province. Are you talking about that?
I'm talking about it. It's a project which is between DPE and education.
let me just verify that. That's what I want to verify with DP. Is that the case? Just on that one? Transnet? It's Transnet. No, I wanted to absolve DPE to say that to the best of my knowledge, it's not a relation. There's no relationship of that program with DPE, so we must not ask them.
There is. Can I say that maybe?
Sorry. Skills development.
Thank you, Chair. The mandate. As is currently of the skills development unit is not focusing on social responsibility program, but we know that Transnet and DINEL are involved in the DINALIDI project. But what we can do, we can engage them to check how do they cascade that to different provinces.
What I wanted to achieve is to say it's not DPE that we must ask. If we may want to ask Transnet, how they broaden that, we'll ask Transnet. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry for bothering you. The background of my question, sometime this year, I had spoken to Transnet requesting them that there is a needy school in the Eastern Cape which has had fairly good results, but they need support. They're offering math and science. They're offering math and science, and they need some support. Now, what I got from Transnet is that there was an agreement between the SOEs and the department. I mean, this could date back, a few years ago when none of our colleagues were there, that every SOE, say, for instance, DINEL would adopt Northern Cape, ESCOM would adopt this one, and provide the same support that Transnet is providing in schools in Free State. I was raising a question, why all the schools are situated in Free State, and Transnet says, no, this is the province that we adopted. You should rather raise your further questions with DPE, and that's what I'm doing.
About this one, when DPE responds to all other questions. Mr. Van Dalen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to know, DPE makes sure that you set targets for SOEs and that they then reach these targets. I wanted to know, what has DPE got in place to make sure that local companies benefit from contracts? It's like... if ESCOM is paying its money, capital money, to invest in infrastructure on mines, with these cost plus 3% mines, where ESCOM pays for the earth moving and all the infrastructure, and then a company like BHP would mine the mine and then sell the coal to ESCOM at cost plus 3%. What has ESCOM or DPE got in place to make sure that ESCOM actually make sure that money gets spent local, if it's possible to spend it locally? And then the other question was that what is DPE doing also with the targets of Transnet to make sure that the trucks get taken off the road? I see Transnet made a profit, a bigger profit, but they actually transported less cargo. What are you doing to make sure that we get the trucks off the road and onto rail? To force them to do that, because that is what DPE should be doing, setting the targets, and in my eyes. Then I see on the one slide it says that DANEL and the A400M aeroplanes, it said it was delayed. I thought it was stopped totally, just as a point of clarity. My other question was then, DANEL, who didn't reach most of its targets, it looks like the naughty boy in the pack. It sets its targets, the targets are set with DPE and DANEL itself, and then they don't reach their own targets. So what are you doing to make sure that they actually are going to reach their targets, or you have to force them? And if a naughty boy is naughty, you give it the hiding. Why are you not giving it the hiding that it deserves? Thank you.
Mr. Santa.
question. Thank you very much. I have learnt with a certain degree of being concerned that a certain party has agreed to go for a conference. I wonder if that conference is not going to turn into war.
Order, Chapter. There you go again. Order.
Thank you very much for your protection, Chapter. My question will border. It's only one question, Chapter. I'm being forced by this man to ask a question. My question will border around government, the mission of DPE, of ensuring that SOEs deliver on government development objectives. If you look into some SOEs, you will find out that they are taking care of themselves and they are, what one would say, their customers. Now, you fail to understand, you fail to see them delivering on governmental developmental objectives. One would want to check what social investment programs do these individual SOEs have so that they deal with issues like poverty and other related social ills. Thank you very much.
Covered by my colleagues.
I want to join the members in congratulating the department. But I also want to further congratulate the department for the document on methodology and impact. I think that helps us a great deal to find one another in terms of the approach to oversight. I think it's a very useful document, which I think should be our Bible, and if the department augments it and improves it, we should be informed. For me, I would have even liked it to be a very concise thing that I can carry with me daily to look at it. 12 o'clock. It's quite helpful. I want to express outrightly my interest to further engage the DDG for energy and the one for transport, the issues of the Transnet and ESCOM as outlined in the shareholder oversight methodology. I think there is very useful information there, but I would also want to gain a very deep understanding, which I think all of us should actually get engaged in and engaged with. So I foresee a time when we will either a school where we will interrogate only this document to assist ourselves to know what to expect and what the department is doing to oversee the SOEs. Having said this, I also want to say to the meeting, to the committee, from where I sit as chair, I think we need to apply a very thorough microscopic eye to DINEL. I think DINEL is getting out of hand. So I would beg the committee that we need special focus to DINEL. If not, in the next quarter, we must prioritize DINEL out of from the annual report moving forward. And in the next 6 months, I think we should have done quite a lot of work that would see DINEL turning around. I think DINEL is becoming worse. There used to be one business entity of Brunel that was problematic now, and there is no sign in the horizon that it's getting better. My questions would be, my first question is a clarity question to members. Whether I heard SAA properly, before I asked my question, when they were presenting their annual report, that they are not planning to purchase any acres. Because I think I heard something differently today, that they are purchasing a 340 acre. Sorry, just help me with my...
Madam Chair, they said they were not purchasing aeroplanes. They were replacing some aeroplanes. They weren't expanding their fleet. They were replacing old aeroplanes. That's the way they explained it to us. But they did talk about replacing them.
No, my other concern is not a question, is that you cannot be saving on manufacturing if you are to impact on the economy. So that's just a red flag that I would like to raise, that is something that needs to be, and I've been harping on this for quite a while now, that I think our focus of SOEs in manufacturing is a little bit wanting, and this is now testified by the fact that you have made savings in the manufacturing arena. My three questions, the one bothered was Sanana's question. Of people who are consulting, how many of them were attached to the department or to the SOE? So I think that's a very serious question. It's worrying to have learned that the DG is now in partnership, a former DG is now in partnership with a former minister. Now, the question I want to ask out of this report is, I hope they are not procuring the two of them from DPE and the SOE, because they are both from the SOE, the minister, if the partnership is really existing. Also, that when people exit the department, there should be, especially if they are senior like DGs, there should be an exit interview as where they were, but also a cooling off period. So that begs us, Parliament, to fast track this issue of cooling off before you go and do it, especially this portfolio committee, because we are the ones that are dealing with SOEs that are dealing with a lot of revenue that is safe revenue. I think we should fast track and speak. And I know the minister is also passionate about this issue, if my memory serves me well, that we should be the one that is pressing for this call for cooling off for people that exit the public sector, so that they must not exit only to come and procure from us immediately after exiting. My two or three questions. I want to congratulate the department and Transnet, especially on the OREX line, and also on the impact of jobs in the Northern States, in particular job creation, because that would be the OREX line would be for exports and would be having a direct impact on the economy. My question to the department is, how are there any personnel employed in the department who do not reflect on the organogram, who are paid by other agencies, who are not paid by from the departmental budget, who are paid by somebody else, and who for that reason might not be reflecting on the organogram, and if they are there, what are their roles? And the background for my question is, every government, especially a strategic department that deals with strategic SOEs, you are at risk of policy influence, or you are at risk of people wanting to know your commercial secrets that are in your SOE's hands. So if you have people who are sitting on your establishment who are paid by other people elsewhere who are either in the private sector or are other nationals or countries, your risk is heightened of people accessing commercial information of your SOEs. The dashboard question, what mechanisms are in place to ensure that data provided by the SOEs as they feed the dashboard is validated? My last concern, the issue of no financial model for SAA and SAA Express, I think we should kind of set the timeline for that model to be in place. Maybe we must get an indication from the department and from the minister when can this be implemented. This is the end of the first round of questions. If we're doing well with time, we may take one more, you know, as clarity questions or follow up questions. Then over to you, Minister, in the department.
Thank you very much for the questions. I will answer the questions and call upon staff to answer certain other questions. The Remuneration Advisory Panel has given me, just starting with the questions, the Remuneration Advisory Panel has given me a draft report. I've had a look at it, and I've asked them to include some other factors that weren't included in that report. And I imagine that that report will be finalized within about 6 weeks to 6 weeks' time, so we'll be able to share the results of that report with yourselves, and also for us to engage. It raises very, very interesting questions about remuneration and complex questions. Now, bear in mind the National Treasury has also done their independent review of remuneration in the SOEs, and we'll be aligning their recommendations with the recommendations that come through this independent panel. In the meantime, we've asked all SOEs, and when they've come for requests to have the remuneration of directors, for instance, approved, we've said no, not until we have the advisory panel reports. The acting DG and the position of the DG, it's been a really, really difficult process. You know, a DG of this department that I think the acting DG will be able to confirm with you is a very, very multi-skilled person. Take a DG of transport. That DG is a specialist on transport. In this department, you've got to have someone who's a specialist on energy, or has very good insight into energy, and that's a huge field. But I have someone who has a specialist insight into transport, because those are two major ones. Into aviation, has to be able to familiarize themselves with munitions and Danel, you know, the arms manufacturing, forestry, all sorts of things. It's a wide range. Now, obviously, you can't find one person who encompasses all of that. But you have to find someone who can actually provide that necessary breadth of skill and insight into the department. Plus, you've also got to have someone who is a contracting specialist, who understands contracts, but also who can read very, and it's very easy with financial analysis. Because contracting and procurement are essential parts of the SOE. So, to get that complex of skills together has been quite a task, and I know that it might be met with some skepticism, but just the kind of salary levels that are available in the public service at DG level for someone with that complex thing, you know, set of skills, is just not simply available for this person. So we tend to find that high-level operative is a person who can be employed in the private sector very easily. I mean, the last person we approached said, listen, you know, I was earning what you can offer me several years ago. You know, I can't go back down there. So that's the kind of problem we've had, but we have before cabinet and will be coming before cabinet within almost immediately. We have a candidate going forward and we hope that. But it is not good to have an acting position like this. It is simply, I think the department can attest, and I must say that the department has responded incredibly well. We met as a team, we looked at what the shortfalls in the department would be, with some people having to assume acting positions. And I must say people have come magnificently to the table and have taken on additional responsibilities and have performed a very, very professional team. And I want to thank the acting DG and the whole team here for the work that they've done in ensuring that the work of this incredibly important work that this department has to do has carried on. So thank you very much for that. Vacancies on SAE, there's no more the question of vacancies on the scale that you're referring to, Dr. Kordenhoff. The vacancies are simply relate now to Transnet. And that issue is shortly going to be resolved. But there's all the others have been filled now in terms of those vacancies. We came into an unfortunate situation in which there were a number of vacancies that were standing, and then with the events of last year, but those have now all been filled. The question of Danelle, and this has been raised by a number of people, and I think it was very, very apparent in the presentation. And I think you're very correct, Chair, in saying that Danelle needs specific focus this year going forward, and we have been giving it focus now. And encouragingly, we're getting a very good cooperation between the DG in Defence and ourselves here. You know, a company that is producing weaponry and that produces weaponry for the sovereign state is very much dependent, firstly, on being able to access international markets. And secondly, it's very dependent on the procurement which that state provides. Now, we all know the problems that happens when, and we see it in local government all the time and in the provincial governments, you know, with the questions of fiscal dumping at the end of the year. And I think Danelle has had some of those problems when procurement starts towards the end of the financial year because there's more certainty about where the money is going to come from. And it's going to be ironing out those kind of problems of procurement. But the particular issue, which I think has come up very strongly here in our presentation, is still the decision about what is strategic and sovereign for this country. And until that defense review is published and we know what is strategic and sovereign, it leaves Danelle in a very uneasy circumstance of not wanting to relinquish certain production activities, even though they might not be profitable, because of the question of sovereignty and what is important. Secondly, it is very difficult for countries such as ourselves to access first world markets for arms production. We normally have to go through an intermediary, and that is have a partnership with a company that has its marketing networks internationally. That is why some of the companies that were privatized, that do have some of the strategic equity partnerships that Danelle entered into have now been performing pretty well because they have that international exposure. And I think Danelle Dynamics is exactly that issue. At this stage, the Department of Defense is still not willing to accept a strategic equity partner in the missiles business. And that is the subject of ongoing discussions between ourselves, National Treasury, and the Department of Defense. And hopefully we will make more progress on this going forward. National Treasury is raising concerns itself about the state of Danelle. What we have said is that there's going to be no further recapitalization. And this is the message that has gone out to every SOE. If you look at the spending on SOEs, the transfers this year, it's virtually nothing. It was only the ones that we were obliged to in terms of the court order, in terms of Alex Corps and whatever. So, you know, we're in economic difficulties as a country and as a world, and there is no recapitalization. And I think sometimes it takes some of our SOEs some time to actually internalize it, because the habit has been that we will recapitalize, but we're not. So Danelle is going to need specific focus, and we welcome assistance from yourselves in how we deal with these very, very tricky issues within Danelle. Danelle Saab Aerostructures, I will ask the team to respond on the Danelle Saab Aerostructures proposal. Let me just say, in answer to one of the questions, the A400M purchase of the military aircraft was cancelled, the aircraft thing was cancelled by the Department of Defense. What Danelle Saab is committed to is producing components. And only one of the three components has been cancelled. The other two are still are there. In case of litigation cases, the former CEO of ESCOM, that case is going to come before the courts in October. That is my understanding. I don't know. The other litigation cases, do you want to speak to it, Ursula?
Thank you, Minister. I just want to check with the Honourable Member that we're talking about the same cases. The Londoloza Papu, Nabera, Equity Alliance, and the Mr. Dutoit against the TSDBF. Okay, on Londoloza, I already reported that new summons were issued by the plaintiff in that matter. And they then requested that they to amend their particulars. However, they failed to meet the deadline for amending those particulars of claim. And that's the current status on that one. Nabera is a matter where the management consultancy firm was suing Alexco and the department some time back. That matter has been in abeyance for a while. It's in the order of, it's about $125 million claim. And the advice that we received from our counsel was that we would allow the matter to stay in abeyance because there is a potential that the claim could be taken over by somebody else if we act on it. So the applicant hasn't acted on the matter. And that's generally... that's generally what we tend to get, is that we get entities institute action against an SOE or government. And then once they've instituted action, they then don't proceed with litigating the matter to its fullest extent. So matters tend to stay in abeyance. And then the third matter is also Equity Alliance, where they also requested to amend their further particulars. And there we have received their further particulars, and we filed a plea. And then the last matter is Mr. Dutoit, I think he's a pensioner, who instituted action against Transnet and the TSDVF and then joined government. And this matter, I think, came just well, we received it just before the committee requested Transnet and government to come and report around the pension increases in the TSDBF. And in that matter, he has instituted action, and we're exploring ways around linking the proposal that Parliament requested from the department. And we're going to explore how we deal with that in line with the matter. So I can't say quite a lot now because that one is still sub judice.
Just piggyback on the litigation issue, to ask DPE to, together with SAA, to report. We've given them whole year, solid year, to report to, if I extend this to the first quarter of next year, to report on litigation matters abroad, particularly in the US and UK. We have, from February this year, we have given them, in fact from November last year, We've given them time to deal with this issue. And in the first quarter of next year, we want them to report on this issue. We cannot give them more time. We would have given them essentially 13 months.
This is the competition. Okay. They should. Yeah, they must come and report. Okay, we'll make a note of that. Okay. Just in terms of policy alignment, Mr. McGuinness' issue on policy alignment with other departments. I think a department of DPE always has to have a policy alignment with their fellow departments. And now the principal ones would obviously be communications, defense, transport, and energy. Now, you've seen the reasons why there's a conflict of interest if an SOE falls under a policy department. And yes, of course, it's a constraint on any of the work that DPE does, because you do not have the authority to enter into policy, into the policy domain. But one accepts that. That is part of how government operates. And the art of doing good work is to have a good relationship with your other departments so that you can achieve the outcomes that you need. In energy, as I've said, there's been extensive engagement with the Department of Energy in the interministerial, as well as in the Interministerial Committee on Energy. And that was a cabinet decision to set up such a body because of the critical issues relating to electricity, not energy, but to electricity. And so there's extensive ongoing engagement, a huge number of working groups that are working towards resolving these issues. So, yes, so I think the alignment is certainly happening, and much more so than it has been achieved in the past. Now, the issues around the rail gauge, can I ask the department to speak?
I do want to just beg your indulgence, a little follow-up on this question of interest, on this question of the reserve of authority. ESCOM, who do they actually account to? Because it seems they make two presentations. Technically, they're supposed to, and sometimes I ask myself, we should exercise oversight over them, but then the Department of Energy. I mean, they also report to them. But you are the central minister. I mean, I would just explain to me the duality, because it bamboozles me. In terms of oversight,
yeah.
Parliamentary oversight.
In terms of oversight, ESCOM falls under DPE. DPE is the shareholder ministry, and your committee would be the oversight committee.
Okay.
So we're responsible for anything that happens in ESCOM. Now, the difference is that until a couple of years ago, ESCOM was responsible for the security of supply of electricity in the country. Okay. Whereas that responsibility with the new legislation now lays in the hands of the Minister of Energy. Okay. So that the Minister of Energy and the Department of Energy, given the predominance of ESCOM as an electricity supplier, will have an ongoing engagement with ESCOM, and correctly so, because that minister must have the freedom to be able to make the policy decisions she needs to make in a good understanding of what the capabilities of ESCOM are. So therefore, the joint hearings that sometimes happen between yourselves are extremely important, because we can't work in silos as government. You know, I'm not going to sort of say to the Minister of Energy, ESCOM's out, stay out. I mean, that's not realistic. But the Minister of Energy and I will engage on electricity matters. But ESCOM will account to us, and we will, in the shareholders' compact, have embedded in that shareholders' compact the requirements that the Department of the Minister of Energy would require of what ESCOM has to produce. Bear in mind, too, that ESCOM no longer does the planning going forward. That has now been done by the Ministry of Energy, and the IRP is a product of that. So ESCOM will work within the mandate assigned it by the Minister of Energy. and we will ensure that they achieve the mandate that they need to achieve, and I think that's that relationship. Can I ask the transport team to talk about the rail gauge issue? I wasn't here.
Maybe you want to talk to rail gauge?
Thank you, Chair. I'll appreciate the help. On the issue of the rail gauge, I think it was more of the lack of congruence on the size of the rail gauge. In my opinion, I think there hasn't been sufficient discussion between the two departments to even establish the extent to which we disagree. That engagement is beginning to happen with the Department of Transport. And in my opinion, I think it's one aspect that needs to be contextualized in the rail policy debate, because the extent to which Transnet is procuring the locomotive and Prasa as well, I think we have to be very clear as a country which strategic corridors we're going to focus on in terms of the regional connectivity issues. And as I said, it's my opinion because we haven't had sufficient engagement with the DOT, which is happening at this stage.
What I can add is that I've had, since our last meeting, joint meeting, I've had about five meetings with Transnet and the DDG, which is the two responsible. I think they're finding one another, and I think there is a commonality that is emerging in terms of the gauge issue. So maybe what we need to do is to plot another meeting where we bring them again, because we had one meeting. But I think I can confidently say that Transnet sees the need to move towards broadening the gauge, and it is a product of the intermittent meetings that we have had that flowed from the last joint meeting, and I've had discussions also with the chairperson of the sister committee of transport on all these issues. In fact, in one meeting that I held with them, that I was also present. So maybe it's to bring these reports of this meeting into a meeting of the two committees again, together with Transnet and Department of Transport. Just before I forget, members, the issue of just slightly going back to energy, you tasked me last week to write to the portfolio committee about the issue of electricity theft and the act, amending the act to make that a criminal offense. I did that. Subsequently, I received a response yesterday from the chairperson who thinks that that is our domain. So, I will have to ask the NA table, or I will have to look at maybe a DPE here. You could assist us. We have a problem of whose responsibility is it to enact, to insert in the act the issue to criminalization of electricity theft. We thought it was Energy Committee. We wrote to them. They wrote back to say they thought this before us. Yes, Minister, thank you.
My understanding is the Minister of Mineral Resources, and she will designate the request. Maybe you're right. The criminalization is a different thing. Whereas the request that initially came to me from Transnet and ESCOM was to reclassify copper. As a, what is it, as a rare mineral, what's that? Precious metal, as a precious metal. And she said that the feedback that she's given me is she said that there are apparently legal difficulties around that, but that her legal team is looking at what other ways that they can deal with this matter so that it's addressed.
Thanks for reminding us about that one, Minister, too. So I will ask yourself, sir, to check with us in terms of the act, which act would we need to be amended or have an insertion in to classify electricity theft as a criminal offense, because our sister committee says it's our role, but we were thinking it's not our role to facilitate that process.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's just to clarify for the people that weren't there, is that Eskom had a presentation and they told us that the theft of electricity is not in the Act and they can't prosecute anybody for the theft of electricity. And then we, as a committee, thought, well, if they are pleading for our help, we will help them. And this is where we are going with that. And if that is in our domain, we must make sure that it happens. The connection to the illegal connections and the theft of electricity, which is not at the moment a criminal offense, so they can't do anything about it. Thank you.
Chair, I just wanted to add a little bit on the rail gauge issue. And what I wanted to say to the committee is that we really need to think of this quite pragmatically. I don't think Transnet is saying that they're against a shift to standard gauge, but the issue, real issue, and we see it on a day-to-day basis in the department, is the biggest challenge within Transnet is freight rail. Performance levels are very poor. They are losing volume, as is picked up by one of the members. And most of the issues there are poor infrastructure, challenging management practice, unreliable rolling stock, and so on. It's got nothing to do with gauge. If we have a situation where we focus all our energies on changing the gauge at considerable cost, we are not going to fix Transnet freight rail. And that really is the challenge that we face as the manager or the oversight of freight rail. The other thing to say, I suppose, is that the cost of a gauge enhancement is not simply just moving one track out so that you get a bigger gauge. All the curvatures have to be realigned. All the tunnels have to be rebuilt. So it's an enormous cost implication for Transnet.
Yes, thank you very much. We understood that to be a very long-term project that was a huge budget. But my interest in my appreciation of your methodology of when I said Transnet State is exactly the issues you are raising of freight rail, rolling stock, the challenges that Transnet is facing, so that we don't only bring the sandbox, but we become part of the process to find the solution to the problem. Thank you for bringing that. Let's proceed, please.
Well, in the fiber project, could the CESCO...
With regard to the fiber project, it was an offshore investment in Mozambique, a really substantial scale of 1.34 billion rand. Within the current economic conditions, it simply is not something we could have supported. And moreover, you know, there was this whole move to discourage further vertical integration pending, you know, resolution of the privatization. Also, the payback period was very long term, 15 years in, and the financial team wasn't really convinced about the ROI, you know. The other thing was that we couldn't see any evidence of SAFCOL's a clear funding plan around the proposal. And that was some time ago. That was the former minister.
But I just want to take for granted we know all the elements just without wasting anybody's time. But please just unpack it. What is this fiber application? What are the elements? What is it involved?
Fiber, apparently it's a growing market segment in the wood, paper, and pulp sector. And in fact, it is an export opportunity. Fiber is a fantastic export opportunity. But in terms of the economic rationale or business rationale for SAFCOL, it just didn't make sense. But in fact, you know, the opportunities around investing in, you know, regional countries such as Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, around afforestation, because it did also have an afforestation element to it. That, you know, is something that, you know, theoretically you can support because you're investing regionally, you're helping the region.
But you also have limitations in South Africa around afforestation. National government set, you know, limits of 100,000 hectares over 10 years, and that's limited to KZN and Eastern Cape. So it does make sense if you're looking at, especially if you're looking at other outputs, saw log, you know, there's a major saw log supply shortage in the country, and that's set to continue for the next 30 years, it's been projected to. But in terms of fiber, it's used in a range of products, so there's a big market for it internationally.
Okay, then Dr. Dex's questions, his hardy annual visits were perennials about the performance of HOEs and why we got them and everything like that. Did they make a contribution to employment? I think the figures are here. If you're going through it, I don't want to go into it. I think for the one, it was 160,000 people who were affected. You know, with the build of the scale that translated Eskom, they're making definite contributions, and I think very significant contributions to employment. Did they contribute dividends to the National Treasury? No, we don't require them to provide dividends. But I think this is where we've got to be clear. Government is not investing in SOEs to make money. Otherwise, government will become like any other commercial, you know, company. That is not the point of investing in SOEs for government to get dividends. Government's investment in SOEs is because there is a strategic significance for why you would want to have a significant investment in certain aspects. And I agree with you, there can be a debate about what is significant and sovereign. But the issue is that the understanding is that the profits that SOEs make be reinvested. It's retained earnings. It's what any company does. You retain your earnings. Okay, other companies distribute to their shareholders. That is not what we're about. And the issue of Eskom is precisely the fact that it was not able to retain its earnings for its future build program. That has led to the difficulties that Eskom is finding itself in. One of the reasons. So an SOE is not there to make profits for government. It's there to make, yes, certainly it's got to make profits, but that's for reinvestment, particularly in its capital expenditure program, to stabilize it. You ask, what is the, are we happy with the performance? Well, I think that is really for the portfolio committee to make a decision on what you're happy or what you're unhappy with. If you look at something like SA Express, for instance, they were the carriers for the World Cup soccer team. They carried all the World Cup soccer teams. Are we unhappy with that? You know? They made a profit this year. Are we unhappy with it? What do we term happy, unhappy? We need to get out of the paradigm that simply because a company is a state-owned enterprise, it's failed and it's doomed and it's a waste of time. And that sometimes is the uncomfortable paradigm that we're working in. We need to be a little bit more subtle about what we're doing. Infraco, for instance. The McKinsey report shows that there has been a significant reduction in broadband costs as a result of the investment that comes from the Eastern Corridor project, but also because of the investment that Infraco made in broadband. Are we unhappy with it? They're making profits. They are attracting a number of very interesting customers. Do we say we're unhappy? You know, what is this word happy? What are we expecting? Is it their strategic mandate that we're happy with? And that is what we would be concerned about government. Transnet, it's building its infrastructure off its own balance sheet. Now, it's not achieving the operational efficiency that we would require of it to achieve. And that is a serious problem. And there I would agree with you that unless Transnet is able to improve its operational efficiency, it has a huge impact on the economy. But the point is Transnet from a period of about 5 years ago has completely transformed its balance sheet. And is able, and it's not a drain on the state, and is able to fund its growth and considerable investment. There are very few companies that are investing in the scale that Transnet is investing. Do going forward. Secondly, the competitive supplier development program in Transnet, where they are encouraging local procurement, well, local development of manufacturing, just not local procurement, is going to have a significant impact on that manufacturing industry. So, you know, when you're saying what are we happy, what we're not happy with, the aspects we're happy with, the aspects we're not happy with. ESCOM, the same issues here. We know the history of what constrained ESCOM in the past. And part of it is government has taken responsibility for it. It's not simply an ESCOM issue. At the same time, how many significant blackouts have we had? We've had no blackouts since that initial period. A 22 billion rand savings that they made on operational costs. All I'm pleading for is that let's not make saints and let's not make sinners out of state-owned enterprises. Let's put them under a very keen appraisal, as the committee has been doing. Keep them to account. And I would say that looking at the performance indicators that we spell out in the shareholders compact becomes extremely important in assessing whether they are achieving what they are meant to achieve. And also maybe commenting on the shareholders compact and seeing whether those are actually giving us the performance indicators that we would want to be putting before them. In terms of InfraCo, the two licenses.
And I want to go on there, but the MEC for Transport in the Northern Cape has asked me to thank the Minister and DP for the projected employment figures, 67,000 that will emanate from Transnet investment program. And they are particularly tasking to keep a close eye on that. But firstly, they are thanking you for the projections. And so I will be having a very effective mandated by my province to keep an eye on those developments. Thank you.
Chairperson, just a point of order. Chairperson, I would just mention to the minister, I didn't use the word happy. I asked you whether you are satisfied with the performance, and I referred mainly to Danel, PBMR, and Transnet, and I also mentioned that we had a meeting with Transport and Transnet where it was said that Transnet's sidelines and in the rural areas, the infrastructure collapsed. And that's why I asked you whether you are satisfied with the performance in your first year at office with the enterprise.
Well, you know, satisfied, happy is the same thing. You can't just say, I'm satisfied, I'm not satisfied. You know, it's a nuanced thing, and I was hoping that we could get to some nuance in meetings of this kind. InfraCo, the two licenses. Yes, they do not have the ECS license. But InfraCo has, and as we know from the McKinsey study that we did, this is going to come down later down the line to assess InfraCo's financial sustainability going forward. But InfraCo has been engaging in an extensive process of looking at what customers it can get and what synergies it can get with other state-owned enterprises like Semtec, which does have an ECS license. And I'm very happy to say that there is ongoing discussions now happening between InfraCo and Semtec to see what synergies we can get. And we see the crisis that Semtec is in. And let us look and let us not prejudge this issue. And InfraCo has been performing well. Let us also say that one of the rivals, which was that golden triangle that of broadband that was going to be installed by Vodacom, MTN, Neotel, that has been experiencing problems itself. So I think InfraCo is one of our state-owned enterprises that we do need to keep under scrutiny. But I do believe that we're not putting it in the top far right-hand corner of very, very high risk at this stage. The fiber project has been... now, the Transnet rail, does it include the expansion of rail? Can you... The 93 billion, could you give details there?
You know, we get the corporate plan, which is a five-year business program, and it details... the corporate investment program for Transnet going forward, and it's very clear about where the 93 billion will be expended. This issue of standard gauge has been something that's emerged much more recently. The corporate plan that we received was prior to the start of this financial year. So there's no explicit mention of standard gauge in that corporate plan. However, we have been talking to Transnet and to DOT around what are the implications around standard gauge. Does it mean that when we're putting new infrastructure, we should consider standard gauge as an option? I think that Transnet has now committed itself to doing quite a detailed study around that, and that will influence what goes into their infrastructure plan. I think, again, if I go back to this pragmatic issue, is if you're building a 20 or 30 kilometer extension, as we are in Mpumalanga, around supporting the coal network, it doesn't make sense for that extension to be in standard gauge because it's connected to the balance of the network. However, if we're putting in new corridor infrastructure, as Rasibi indicated, then maybe we need to consider alternative approaches.
Okay. And then the question of consultants that Gloria was raising, can HR respond to that all? Fine.
Thank you, Jay. The consultants that are listed at the on page 140 of the annual report do reflect 25 million. However, this is in line with public service regulations on reporting of consultants, and it refers to public service regulation chapter 1, part 3, J, 2, and 3, which is quite specific about what has to be reported there, and it was cross-checked with the Auditor General both last year and this year. Bearing in mind that if you look at consultants on the slide that I provided, you'll see there's 40 million there, and that would include, for instance, internal auditors where we've co-sourced and we have actually partnered with a company for internal audit. Being so small, we have partnered with that. We can give more detail on this, but we try to break it down in terms of what we normally give the portfolio committee every year. But that is why the reflection there, it's for ad hoc. In fact, I've got the definition here somewhere. It's for ad hoc advice on intellectual properties, on intellectual advice, provides in terms of specific contracts or any ad hoc professional services to give expert advice, drafting proposals for specific tasks that are technical, intellectual, and it goes on further than that in the public service regulations. I think there was your further question was in terms of, so I hope that I've answered that adequately. The gifts and donations.
I just have to clarify a little. I'm trying to get at the point that in your statement here on page 94, you've got consultants contracts, you've got that down as 51 million.
That's right.
And you've list, and this is 25 million.
Yes.
It's not tying up.
No, it doesn't tie up because of the definition in the public service regulations of the utilization of consultants. I can forward to the committee the extract of those public service regulations and how the consultants on this page are defined, because they are project-based and we have done it exactly according to the public service regulations. The other consultants that are used are not required to be disclosed on the schedule. I hope that answers. We disclose 51 million consultants. That is made off of agency fees, co-source, all sorts of different kinds of things. But in the public service regulations, which is public service regulation, chapter 1, part 3, section J, 2, and 3, it clearly states that we have to disclose consultants, but of a specific nature. Doesn't include all the consultants that one uses in the department. There are different classifications, and we have disclosed what is required in the public service regulations on that page. I can provide the committee with a copy of the public service regulation, and this is in also in consultation with the Auditor General on our disclosures, which they were quite happy with. So I hope that clarifies that for you. The gifts and donations are also addressed. The vacancy rate, I'll hand over to someone else, but the gifts and donations, we do have a gifts and donations committee, gift donation sponsorships and all that, where we do consider applications from different organizations. You'll see there's quite a large amount for the 16 days of activism, which is an annual project that we contribute to, and it goes to one of the causes in that that's been analyzed, and it was also in partnership with the SOE, who contributed money, and we don't release the money from, we first verify that the project is correct. We even go and have a look at it. The small amounts, we receive requests. We go into them, we see that they are legitimate organizations. We ask for audited financial statements. We check that they are actually registered organizations and such like. And then we assess their request, and we then send it through with our recommendations to the Director General, in this case the Acting Director General, and we then make the contributions to the organizations that have applied to us. I don't know if there was anything else.
Yes. Can anybody apply? That's also part of the question. You know, and so on what basis do you sort of say, well, we can entertain this or we can't entertain it?
Anyone can apply. We can't prevent people applying. And then they come to the committee, and then we have different criteria. We have a charter, and we have criteria which we judge them. You know, we have a look at the things. Some of them we refer. We'll refer them to the Department of Health, or we just refer them to different other departments where it would be more appropriate. And then we do a very critical assessment of these applications.
Can I just ask you for what Kudoria or to the committee?
Your assessment criteria, your criteria, and that will be very helpful. Then going on to the Dinner Lady program. I think we would have to engage with Transnet on this matter. It's really not, it hasn't involved DPE on this. The CSDP program, the checks and balances. I don't know if anyone in the CSDP would want to comment on that.
I think the key thing in CSDP, there's this famous philosophical question. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does the tree actually fall? So I'm going to respond to this issue of monitoring and evaluation is to say I think there's very, very little doubt that we really are making significant progress in the implementation of the competitive supplier development program. I think evidence of this is in the recent Transnet annual report. Supplier development was given a very high level of profile with the CEO making significant commitments to the locomotive fleet procurement in particular, but also around leveraging, you know, the port equipment sector for the development of an associated industry. We can see an enormous amount of activity within both Eskom and Transnet around what I was presenting today, the re-engineering of their procurement processes and capabilities so that supplier development concerns are integrated into the very heart of the process
as opposed to an afterthought. I think, you know, to get to a position from where the SOEs were, say, 3 years ago, where supply and development simply and straightforwardly wasn't the consideration, to a situation where it's just part and parcel of the procurement culture is a continuous change management process. And the systems are now being embedded, but the senior management are driving the very big deals, such as in locomotives, in Transnet. So we can see a lot of progress. Now, having said that, what I'm not going to fudge is that the monitoring and evaluation process is difficult, and we haven't solved that problem yet. Let me give you an example of why it's difficult. In locomotives, the recent deal that we've just done with General Electric around the procurement of 100 new locomotives, we've effectively we're at about just over 50% national value add local content. We've overtaken Brazilian industrial capability in this space, okay? But we're not near to where we want to be, which is, you know, 70-80% national value add. But Brazil has been working on this particular issue for the last 12 years, and we've already overtaken them. So you've got these very chunky components to locomotives, for example, the engines, the gearboxes that are very, very complex to master industrially, and it'll take a lot of effort and time to get there. However, on the other side, if you're dealing with something like structural steel, in the initial design of the boilers for Medupi, we were going to import 40% of the structural steel. Eskom intervened with the original equipment manufacturer and with national industry. They changed the specs of the designs. There was negotiations. There was this investment, 800 million, 900 million rand investment in plants, and we've got it to almost 100% local content in terms of the structural steel. The point that I'm making is that you set very, very different targets for structural steel than what you do for locomotives. So from a monitoring and evaluation point of view, it's very, very hard. You can't have a kind of blanket, you know, target that will cover all the different components and systems that are being procured. So what we're trying to do is develop a system that takes into place this complexity, and the honest answer is we're not there yet, neither at a DPE level or at an SOE level. What we are doing, though, is we're working closely with the DTI around establishing a kind of joint governance processes to collaborate with the SOEs to see how we can come to the most pragmatic solution for what are very, very complex problems. So I think that's the most honest and comprehensive answer I can give to that question.
Dr. Kornov, you want to ask a follow-up question? Can I just say that I will feel your response with the determination to say that when we do oversight like we will do in November, we would like to see where this extra capacity is located that you have produced together with General Electric. If you say you have surpassed the Brazilian market, and if you say that we are bringing in local content, we would like to see this emerging industry, and we want you to go and show them to us. So that we have to be doubting Thomas for the sake of oversight and holding you accountable. It's very easy to take your word from here, but we would like to see your significant issues. That's also my question of manufacturing that I always told. I think then those are the underreported manufacturing contributions that you are making, that you are only mentioning when we are being told that we don't see in your report.
I think that's imminently reasonable. I think what we can do is organize a tour of both Eskom-related and Transnet-related facilities and investments that have resulted from the program.
Thank you.
The issue of transformation, particularly in Dunedin. The question is whether there has been any improvement. I wonder if the Dunedin team can respond to that.
There has been some slight improvement, but even at the last AGM, I think that was an issue that was raised by Minister to the board, that the board needs to make greater efforts into addressing the pace of transformation in Dinao. So this is something that the reviewed board will be looking at, and we've set certain targets even in their shareholder compact and in the strategic intent for them to work towards. So we'll be monitoring those very, very closely.
Chair, just a quick one. What's the hold up insofar as that is concerned?
Well, the key issues has been around, given the specialized nature of some of the skills in that industry, the company had to undertake a lot of skills training and apprenticeship programs. So to actually get the numbers right, has taken them a bit of a longer time than they had anticipated. But they are involved in a lot of skills development programs. We're talking engineers, artisans, and very specialized aeronautics engineering skills here. And they've been working towards those. So I think the communication from the DPE has been that they need to make incremental improvements on that.
Minister, how many questions are we left with? Most of Mr. van Dalen's questions have been answered. To see if there's anything from his. Okay. Okay, you were asking about the corporate social investment programs of SOE. An important question, because corporate social investment is a function of many large companies. But let me just give you a flavor of the problem. There was a member of parliament that asked a question to know what has every SOE given in terms of social investment. And you looked at something like Transnet, and it was page after page after page after page after page after page. It was huge. And we can get that question for you and make it available to all committee members. In fact, that should become a standard practice. Is it a standard practice that members, then you would have seen that. That is, you know, when a question gets answered, that you see it. Now, and if you look at the amounts, they were smaller amounts. Then you look at other companies, and they have less number of clients but higher amounts. Now, government developmental agenda is not corporate social investment. Government's developmental agenda is for the companies to do what they should be doing, providing the infrastructure for this economy to grow or to provide the manufacturing capability that is required as a strategic objective of government. So it's not for SOEs to be engaging in all ranges of things. But nevertheless, each SOE does have a corporate social responsibility program. Now you look at something on the furore that was made, say, around the World Cup. Now, there's a question that has just been asked. What did these companies spend on T-shirts? Now, there was a certain, you know, on World Cup paraphernalia. Now, some people are going to say, and this is the dilemma that SOEs find themselves, Some people are going to say, why didn't you invest as a patriotic South African? Why didn't you have every member of your staff coming to work in a T-shirt on Football Friday? Others are going to say, that's a waste of the taxpayers' money. And this is a dilemma that SOEs can find themselves in, is that there can be different views on what that corporate social investment is. And exactly as we saw here, why are you investing in Free State and why are you not investing there? And it's very dangerous to engage SOEs within when there are different competing interests. I think the best that we should do, and I think it is the correct, is that they need to become very clear and transparent about what their guidelines are. And I'm not sure that we in DPE have actually raised that question forcibly enough. We're satisfied that they're not spending massive amounts of money on corporate social investment. You know, it's not out of kilter. But in the departments in DPE, there's a finite amount that's allowed, and once it's gone, you know, it's budgeted in. What are the policies, what are the corporate social investment programs? Because you also don't want them carrying favor and using these corporate and gifts and donations and all kinds of things to carry favor either. So I think anyone who saw the answer to these questions would be fairly satisfied that there's a responsible program that is taken by these companies. But I do think we need to be asking them for what is their rationality. What is the rationale underlying many of these? And you would notice what Transnet does, for instance. I mean, Transnet has that, what's it called, the train, the health train. Pelopepa, yes. I mean, and that is massive. And during this recent strike, they've played an incredibly important role. And they're going to be putting another train on. Now, you know, you could come to me and say, what made them, does Transnet decide to invest in this? Often it's a judgment of the board of Transnet that this was a good project, and we would concur with that. Chair, you wanted clarity on SAA not planning to purchase. You've got that clarity on the aircraft. Exit interviews. Oh, the cooling off period. I think Parliament itself that needs to start looking at this legislation around cooling off, because it places people in invidious positions. You take someone who's like an electrical engineer, someone like Chris Fording, for instance, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of the electricity industry. You know, and you take all of our people along here. They have, you know, they are regarded, you know, as people who really know their stuff. Are we saying to them that hope they'll stay until they're 70 years old in DPE? But if they want to move on, that they can't practice their profession. You know, are we saying that? I mean, look at the skills that these people have developed. Are we saying they can't do that for 2 years? But what are they going to do then? That's the one side of the thing. But I think the issue that you're raising is people who set up companies and then get into procurement have an inside knowledge of the different companies. And I think that is certainly, we put our foot down on the example that you mentioned, and we took the necessary steps to protect DPE and particular companies, but that should not be the thing. I think you're absolutely right on that. Are there any personnel in the department who do not reflect on the organogram? There's one person who's an advisor to me, who is my energy advisor, being paid by the Clinton Foundation. I've worked with the Clinton Foundation in health. There is no interference from them at all in his mandate, but I needed someone, because of the IMC in energy, to be able to just have an energy focus on that, and that's just a contract that will end in a couple of months' time. And they don't give any policy influence on that. The question of the dashboard, how is data validated? Can I ask the team to respond to that? I think that's a very good question.
The way the dashboard is has been developed is in such a way that at the SOE side, the All dashboard users have different access rights and usage rights. Some people only have viewing rights. Some people have data capture rights, and some other people have approval rights. So to ensure the integrity of the information that is on the dashboard, at the SOE you will have data capturers. But that information the dashboard will not be updated and with that information until the approver, who would be the designated responsible or official in the SOE, and in this case, our requirement is for the CFO to actually sign off on all that, or on all that information that has been captured by the different data capturer. That ensures that the integrity of the information that we receive is actually as contained in the quarterly report that has been signed off by the SOE board. So even on the DPE side, it's the same process. You will have some people with just viewing access and other people with just data capture access. Then the DDG, who is responsible for that SOE, will be the one to approve that data, and only then will the dashboard be updated with that data.
What financial model for SAA and SAA Express? Can you clarify that?
In the case of SAA, you have a sound entity with very strong profitability. In the case of SAA, we've been modeling them financially for probably the last 3 to 4 years and monitored that quarterly. And because there's a monthly reporting cycle in SAA, there's two SOEs that report to us and report to Treasury and ourselves collectively on a closer interval than each quarter, and that is SAA and Danel. And there's a monthly reporting cycle that is set in place. We don't use each of those months as inputs into our financial model, but we do use each of the quarters in the case of SAA, not in the case of SAC.
Those are all the questions, unless there's one that anyone here feels that has not been answered.
There are no questions, Minister. I don't find my club, but it's not satisfied. I will find a way of calling and channeling my questions. I just want to thank the department and the minister once again for good work. But also, I will raise a concern that I have observed personally with the SOE. Is this revolving syndrome of personnel moving from one SOE into the other? For me, it signifies, I need to be convinced that it does not signify lack of growing expertise, growing capable personnel. If you find a persistent syndrome of people leaving transfer to go to SAA, the other one exiting SAA to go to FCOM, the other one leaving FCOM to go to transfer, that's a phenomenon that's very strange that I'm picking up, that I think the department should monitor and curb. I don't think that I fully accept that people working in the DPE and in the SOEs are people of particular knowledge and skills. But I don't think that it is in our interest to allow the phenomenon to grow and to continue. Maybe there are underlying problems that we don't know of, which we want to know. What are those underlying problems if they are there? But this is not the question for today. It's something that I have been observing and thinking about lately. I would like to thank the committee and the department and the minister for a very fruitful meeting. I would like to thank you for your condolences to myself and my family. I would like to wish you a very happy and productive meeting of Friday. I hope that when I receive the report next week, it will be a report that is pointing the way forward to solving
the problem of pension defined benefit funds for Transnet employees. And because we are going into recess, a kind of a little bit of a break, I wish you happy in using the minister's work, constituency work, and a bit of rest. And thank you for your cooperation this quarter, particularly when I was limping. And I'm still raising the issue, and please help me to raise it, of no whip. No whip for the whole year. It's very untenable. Thank you very much. It's heavy on my shoulders. Thank you. Bye.